We are live for another episode of the Joel and Blair Show. It is the 28th of March, 2025. And should be a good show tonight. We've got a few stories to cover, a few talking points. And I told Blair, no doing legs at the gym before the show because it completely drains all of the energy from his brain and he can't... He starts getting frustrated at having to do the show because he just wants to kind of like sit there in silence. So he, I think he did like back or something today, right? I find that too. When you do deadlifts or squats or whatever, it like afterwards, you become a slight mental potato. So like if you go hard, honest, you go talk not so much, but
I'm pretty much frustrated at having to do anything ever, and I always just want to sit there in silence. But it gets slightly worse after a leg workout. I'm just kidding. I love you guys, and I love these streams. I actually look forward to them most weeks, and this one's going to be a good one. Joel and I had a really interesting conversation on the phone today. Joel rang me up about like 2 or 3 hours ago, and he's like, what are we going to talk about on tonight's stream? And we had a bit of a discussion back and forth, and we came up with like a pretty good general theme that we'll try to stick to. I think it's going to be a good night. And by the way, I'm really hungry and I haven't eaten and have this big bowl of pasta in front of me. So never mind me. I'm going to mute my microphone and every now and then I'll be just eating pasta. But I hope that's not rude. I hope it doesn't offend anyone. Actually, you know what? I don't give a fuck. I'm eating my dinner. I'm letting you guys know I'm eating my dinner in between my statements.
Well, I'm offended because about 20 minutes ago, I realized, oh, shit. It's already after 8 and I forgot to do anything about dinner. And so I was like, well, you know what? I'm just going to have to suffer through this stream hungry as fuck because of my own lack of time awareness. And now you're just going to sit there and eat pasta the whole time. So,
Mate, you're the captain of the ship.
Like a pickaxe and just like take that pasta off you or something. I don't know.
This is the burden of leadership, my friend. You are the captain of this ship. I'm allowed to have a recess. Like, I'm just a sailor. You are the captain, man. So... do your job, man. Champion this cause. I'm going to eat my pasta.
Yeah, so anyway, let's get into some of the subjects that we want to discuss on the show tonight. And I think the first one we can discuss is this, because I posted about it on Telegram. There was a tweet put out by the Australian Christian Lobby a few days ago. When was it put out? It was put out 2 days ago. And basically, it was just in reaction to NSN flyers. I think some of the boys had distributed them near Canberra. They did just putting them in people's letterboxes, just like, sign up to the NSN. This is what we're about. They say Australia for the white man on them. And Jacob wrote a little like blurb thing just about, just a few paragraphs. And it just has like a how to sign up or get in touch with the organization. We put it out there and, you know, occasionally people will reach out because of putting them out there. But part of putting them out there isn't just to get people to sign up. It's also just to create some, you know, just general awareness in the public that we exist and what we stand for and just make the public aware of us. And so that's why we do these letterbox drops and so on from time to time. Anyway, so some of the boys up near Canberra did this, and this is what the Australian Christian Lobby had to say. So this is apparently one of the pertinent issues facing Australian Christians right now. To quote, over the weekend, North Canberra residents found racist neo-Nazi flyers in their letterboxes distributed by the National Socialist Network. The material titled Australia for the White Man promoted appalling rhetoric, equating immigrants to scabs and garbage. Now, the term scab, by the way, is a common term. The reference is scab labor, meaning that, you know, immigrants parasite. Are being brought
like,
in.
That's an Australian expression for, like, being a parasite, right?
It's not only an Australian expression. It's in English. It's used in America. It's used in... Typically, you'll hear it being used by unionists talking about, you know, people who work in a union-based industry who don't participate in strikes and don't sign up to the union. That basically, you know, don't make the sacrifices to have solidarity with their fellow workers. But obviously we're using it in the sense of the government importing, you know, cheap foreign labor to undercut the value of our labor, which is clearly one of the main motivations of mass immigration and why, you know, it has so much corporate support. Anyway, quote, to go back to the quote, as Christians, we believe that every person is made in the image of God and worthy of dignity and respect. These extremist views are appalling, un-Australian, and must be met with strong condemnation. Now, I'm just going to come in here. Number one, these so-called extremist views of Australia for the white man and that immigrants are scabs, these are the views of the founders of Australia. These are the views of the people who federated the country, the leaders of the country, particularly the laborist movement. But, you know, basically these are the views that were common in Australia when it was founded. The Australia of World War One, the Australia of World War Two, the Australia of the White Australia policy, the first half of Australia's existence as a federated state. These were the views. Australia for the white man isn't a phrase that we came up with. Australia for the white man was a slogan of Australian nationalism going back to the pre-federation period, back to the late 19th century. So the idea that this is appalling and un-Australian in particular is just absurd, or that it's extreme. And also the idea that every person is made in the image of God, let's say we accept that, which, you know, is debatable, obviously, it's very debatable, but let's say even if we accept that, and why does that mean that white Australians don't get to have our own country? Why does that negate the fact that non-white labor is being brought in to undercut Australian labor? How does that negate the fact that race is nevertheless real and that a lot of these migrant demographics fundamentally incapable of civilization? They're a lot more violent. They're engaging in disproportionate criminal activity and so on, particularly violent criminal activity. We can't have discussions about any of these things, apparently, because that's contrary to the Christian teachings. It's just wrong. Australia, when we had the White Australia policy and we kept all the Browns out of the country, Australia back then was way more Christian. The average Australian actually went to church back then. Only now that almost no one actually goes to church anymore has it become common to have the opposite morality that, you know, actually anyone can be Australian and it's un-Australian to be a racist and all this nonsense. So it's absurd. Anyway, to continue the quote, though the size of the network in Canberra remains unclear, there are concerns that these groups are experiencing growth amongst disillusioned young men searching for strong leadership and robust debate on important political issues facing our nation. As leaders, we must consider what kind of political environment is giving rise to such disenfranchisement. Legitimate issues like the housing crisis, unsustainable immigration, weakened national identity, divisive diversity and inclusion policies, rising anti-Semitic and anti-Christian rhetoric cannot be ignored. Suppressing healthy debate on these issues only fuels frustration and drives people to the fringes. We need open, respectful discussion, not censorship, to prevent dangerous ideologies from taking hold. Leaders must set the standard for constructive dialogue, modeling respect, dignity, true inclusivity to a generation increasingly alienated by ideological extremes. This statement doesn't really make sense. What they're basically saying here is that basically the concerns that we have are actually rooted in legitimate grievances, that the political establishment is unresponsive to those grievances, that we shouldn't be censored, but nevertheless, that somehow we need to be deplored as apparently what we're putting forward is deplorable. And apparently the Christian lobby needs to come in and focus upon this, not the countless examples of blaspheming against Christ that occur, particularly due to activists on the political left. Whenever there's a gay rights rally or a trans rights rally or anything of that nature, there is always blasphemous depictions of Christ. There was obviously a famous depiction, or I should say infamous depiction quite recently, of left-wing activists. One dressed up as like Jesus, simulating some kind of like gay sex act with there was one dressed up as Jesus with an Aboriginal basically throwing a spear at Christ, like killing Christ. But they were dressed up like in gay bondage gear. Apparently, the Australian Christian lobby isn't too concerned about the communists and how much they hate Christ. They're worried about the National Socialist Network, an organization that doesn't engage in anti-Christian rhetoric, that has many Christians involved, that isn't fundamentally hostile to Christian values. Meanwhile, our political enemies are the ones that are pushing all of this degenerate sexual morality that supposedly is condemned by your Bible, right? Back when Australia was white nationalist, it was a Christian country. National Socialist Germany was a Christian country. The majority of the people in National Socialist Germany or in white nationalist Australia went to church. So is nationalism the enemy of Christianity? Or is the enemy of nationalism actually the enemy of Christianity? If you just look at it quite clearly, it's clear that the political establishment and the moral and ideological paradigm that we are dissidents against, that we are opposing, is the same paradigm that is promoting deeply anti-Christian moral values and basically is presiding over the destruction of Australia's Christian identity and ethos, right? So Blair and I are not practicing Christians, but I mean, it's just so unnecessary. Anyway, this was put out and they copped a lot of flack in the comments section and, you know, it got ratioed multiple times and so on. But I found that to be an interesting case. And, you know, they're spending time coming out here. Look how they worked in here, rising anti-Semitic and anti-Christian rhetoric. You know, you could say that Christianity is anti-Semitic itself from a certain characterization. The Jews are not depicted in very sympathetic terms in the Gospels, for example. And this idea that this group seems to have, which is that part of defending Christian interests is somehow defending Jewish interests. Jews, which are literally the group that killed Christ, that rejected Christianity, that Christianity was created in reaction to their religion. All the Jews that converted to Christianity, or the people of Judah that converted to Christianity back in the day, their descendants today are not Jews. Their descendants today are of other Christian ethnic groups. The Jewish people were only held together through their rejection of Christ, through, you know, the many centuries. They have completely antithetical values to Christians on multiple dimensions. So why is the Australian Christian lobby defending the Jews? You know, that's not in the interest of Christians. Well, obviously the Australian Christian lobby is captured by, you know, we know this, they're captured by Zionists. So the Australian Christian lobby is just it's a fraud. It's a fraudulent institution. It doesn't actually defend Christian morality in a robust way. It should be focusing on things like gay marriage. It should be focusing on things like abortion, things that Christians supposedly care about, right? Why is it defending Jews? So anyway, I found that to be interesting, but also indicative of a deeper reality, because there's many times, you know, I walked past a church in Melbourne last night and it had, you know, gay flags all over it and Aboriginal flags all over it and a giant poster at the front of it, saying that it was like a message that was against coal and gas extraction or something. Now, whatever your opinion is on, you know, basically coal mining or natural gas, you know, procurement or whatever, why is a church displaying something like that? It's clearly like a left wing, like a far left, like political slogan. Churches have become entirely hijacked in this country by far left politics, but also just by like left wing politics, politics that is completely antithetical to the Bible, where like you'll literally have pro-gay preaching and so on. So shouldn't Christians be worried about this rather than pointing their finger at the Nazis, you know, and oh, every man is, every race is made in the image of God, so we've got to like bow down and worship at the feet of immigrants and all this nonsense. You know, Australia used to be a Christian country. Now it's a multicultural country. That means it's bad for you if you're a Christian. You used to be able to say Australia was a Christian country, it should have Christian values. Now you can't say that because it's contrary to the doctrine of multiculturalism. Who's standing up against multiculturalism? It's people like us. So, you know, this is, you know, typical of a lot of these Christian politicians. They'll take the easy shot, but they won't take the hard shots. And it's directly contrary to the spirit, apparently, of what of Christ himself. Jesus Christ wasn't a collaborationist with the regime. He was a dissident. He was a revolutionary. He ended up being executed by the state for his beliefs. He repudiated the religious and political authorities of his day. He said, "My kingdom is not of this world, but the next. Store up your riches in heaven, not on earth. Conduct yourself with a higher morality and a higher honor that answers to God, not to man. I don't see any of these values today in these Christian political movements. You know, they're a disgrace.
It's as though the Christians, a lot of these like Pentecostal, you know, sing-along Sunday churches, it's like they model their faith more on Judas than on Christ, because they keep taking the money from government funding. They've got their position within the system and they're dependent on maintaining that position to keep the cash rolling in. And as you said, it's antithetical to the spirit of Christ. Christ was a rebel. He rebelled against the money changers. He drove the money changers out of the temple. He didn't take the money. Judas took the money. And that's the difference. So you've got to be careful if you're a Christian out there that you're not following a church that's really a church of Judah or Judas rather than Christian, I think. But I think that Australian Christian Lobby statement, which I think was made on X, it needed more 5G towers, man. It doesn't have enough 5G towers attached to it. I sent you a couple of photos, actually. I don't know if you can bring one of those up on screen share, if you can be bothered, because all throughout Victoria, in the suburbs surrounding city of Melbourne, the churches have been converted into 5G towers, basically. They've got all this technology like installed onto the side of what was previously just an Anglican church, a local church, but they've done some sort of deal with telecommunication companies. I don't know who's getting the money. Uniting Church seems to be a big offender. I don't know what's going on with Uniting Church, but they're known to, you know, adopt left-wing ideological policies, that kind of thing. And a lot of their churches seem to have this 5G technology bolted onto the side. And this is just one such example sent in to me by a friend of mine. After I posted about it, he started noticing it too in the southeast region of Melbourne. And there are dozens and dozens of churches where this has happened. Some of them are really sinister too. I sent you a second image because I want you to bring up the second image if that's possible, mate, because the second one exposes that they're actually trying to do, or they're making some effort to conceal it too, or to make it look like it's part of the building so it's not so obvious what they've done, because they're taking the money. They're Judists. They're not Christians. They're doing deals with the beast system. And that's, you know, what's the Australian Christian Lobby have to say about this? Obviously, like, that's not really something they want to touch on because there's money to be made there, right? But they'll go for the safe target, the real dissidents, the people who aren't making any money, the people who are criticizing the system in the most honest, forthright way possible, the way Christ probably would have done. Yeah, you'll attack those people because that's your safe target, right? It's just cowardice, man. It's cowardice that they've chosen to single you out, the Christian Lobby, while all this shit's going on, while their churches are being turned into 5G towers, and someone within the church lobby group's making bank from it, and they're just ignoring all that. It's just embarrassing.
And obviously they're singling us out because they're taking the Zionist money. They're in the pocket of the Jews, and obviously the Jews don't like us. But anyway, I mean, this is why no one goes to church in Australia anymore, because Christians, insofar as they represent themselves in any kind of public-facing way, are a fucking embarrassment. They're an embarrassment. They come across as weak. They come across as unprincipled. They don't have any kind of romance or idealism. Perhaps many would say good riddance. But nevertheless, I think it's a pathetic and kind of sad display. You know, like, say what you want about Christianity, it has at least be an honest Christian, at least embody the values that you supposedly stand for. At least that would be respectable. But the hypocritical Christians, these soft, feeble, weak Christians that can't even defend their own belief system or that compromise their own belief system. Yeah, it's a pathetic display, but it's indicative of a deeper problem, right? It's indicative of a deeper problem in our society, which is that everyone in politics, almost entirely, of all different persuasions, is fundamentally a fraud. There are very few, like, actually ideologically sincere actors in the system, representing almost any position. In any kind of established way in Australia, I would say. You know, I can acknowledge when I have a political enemy or a political opponent, who has a different ideological position to mine, I can at least acknowledge if someone is sincere and they just have different beliefs than me. That's one thing. And I could say also that they have those beliefs because I could psychologize why they have those beliefs and say, well, there's something fundamentally weak or cowardly about them, which is why they believe that instead of what I believe. And that could be true. But nevertheless, there is at least somewhat sincere believers out there. But then you have, in pretty much all institutionalized Australian politics, no sincere believers. You have frauds from the top to the bottom that are all collecting a paycheck and are all maintaining a pretense in order to maintain a career in politics in one way, shape, or form, as opposed to actually fight for anything in particular. I see this on the left and the right, but more on the right than the left, frankly. The left seem to have more sincere true believers than we do. And that's one of the big reasons why they win and we lose. There was another story that kind of ties into this that I was talking about this week, that I saw this week, which is maybe I should actually play this video. So there's Friendly Geordie is a well-known YouTuber, and he's a shield for the Labor Party. Like it's established that, you know, he's getting paid by the Labor Party to be a Labor Party shill. But he has a really big YouTube account. I think he has, you know, over 1 million subscribers. He gets a lot of traction online. He's pretty well established. He's been around for some time.
Is there actually proof? Is that like confirmed fact? There has been proof that the Labor Party's paying him?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's obvious anyway. Sue me then if you think you haven't, and then we'll have discovery in court and let's see if you, let's see, Jordan. Is that his name? I think it is. Jordan Shanks, I believe is his real name.
Don't know.
Anyway, so the thing is, though, is that he is kind of interesting because he does kind of flirt with, like, literal far-right positions on many issues. He's very critical of the Israel lobby, Jewish power. He sometimes says the right thing on many other issues as well. And so he's kind of like an interesting figure for that reason, and that's why he has popularity. He's unlike most Australian political commentators who are obvious shills but don't have any kind of dynamism, he actually has some dynamism and he's able to kind of channel this kind of pseudo-dissident energy into like a Labor Party shill, you know, platform, basically. And so he's effective in that sense, in a way that you don't really see many other Australian, you know, commentators capable of being. That's probably why he's so popular. Anyway, he never really talks about us in particular. He kind of leaves us alone. But recently, he put out a little clip, a hit piece on Senator Gerard Rennick from Queensland. And he brought me up and he brought the National Socialist Network up. I'll play the clip and we can analyze it because this is actually quite interesting, I think, to break down.
Honestly, it is criminal what the mainstream press does not report.
Look at this guy. Senator Rennick, up until very recently, was a proud member of the mainstream parliamentary party, the good old coalition. Then he left and he's been trying to form a minor party
with the help of such fuzzy characters as the National Socialist Network. That's exactly what you think it is. Let's have a look at some of their little conversations that they're having online.
Jim Roberts discussing the white Australian policy with Senator Gerard Rennick.
What's there to discuss?
A history lesson?
Yeah, I'm sure that's what it was.
Joel Davis, who censored, mind you, states later,
talked to Senator Rennick last night at his X space before I was banned.
Jesus, he was banned from X.
Well done, Senator. Crazy to actually feel represented by an actual elected politician.
Yes, yes, couldn't have put it better.
Senator Rennick, according to them, represents the National Socialist Network. The leader of the opposition wants the senator that represents the National Socialist Network. He stated that he'd endorse Rennick a second time if he ran for LNP pre-selection. You know what does surprise me about that? Not so much the views of Peter Dutton. I think we all kind of guessed that that would be the case. But it's more the fact that they're always giving this whole thing of free speech. And look, that's all well and good. If they did stick to just that, and then they did want a guy that represents Nazis back into their party, yeah, okay, that's defending free speech. But this is the same party that me, who made some lewd jokes about the broads, and then they have a bunch of their fogies going up in the mainstream press, in Parliament, Friendly Geordie has to be distanced and condemned by the Labor Party. He said that Nicole Flint looked Dilly in a garbage bag. Where does it end? Well, now I'm asking, where does it end? It is always the same with the Liberals. They don't care. They don't want a better world. They just want them to be re-elected for the sake of being re-elected.
Isn't that the entire premise of parliamentary party politics, though? Isn't every party just trying to get elected for the sake of being elected? How does that differentiate Liberal from Labor Party? Obviously, this commentary, it's just like that party bad, which reeks of sponsorship from the other party. And that's what I commented on that specific video, because obviously it's just like, this is like anti-Liberal Party propaganda. And when you're pushing that kind of stuff and you're looking for reasons to associate, you know, people, members or former members of the Liberal Party, you know what I mean, for the purposes of slander or whatever. I mean, that's what the video is about, it seems. But, well, I don't know. What do you think, Joel?
Well, there's a few things, which is that, number one, what he was referencing when I spoke to Gerard Rennick on a Twitter space just before I was banned from X, and when I was happy about what he said in the Senate, was because I spoke to Rennick about, and this was a couple months ago, I spoke to him about how basically all of these, you know, what's been happening in Australia lately, that there's been all of these contrived fake terrorist, like, you know, hoaxes, you know, fake terrorist attacks in order to legitimize, you know, hate speech laws to protect the Jewish community, right? And that, you know, all this stuff stinks to high heaven. The official story doesn't add up, you know, and so on. And I went through the talking points, and Senator Rennick said, yeah, I see what you're seeing. And, you know, I agree with you, and I'm going to be voting against the legislation. But I said, well, yeah, but it's going to pass. So you need to do more than just vote against it. And then he went into the Senate the next day, and then a lot of the same talking points that I used in the Twitter space, he went and used in the Senate. And I was like, ah, like, it's, you know, he called it out. So, and then Rennick then has spent, you know, some time in his public statements in the time since calling out the Israel lobby, calling out the nefarious influence of the Israel lobby in Australia, and so on, calling out the Mossad. So, you know, he's done well. I would say that he's probably the best senator in Australia right now, Gerard Rennick. I don't agree with him on everything, obviously. He's cucked on race from my perspective. You know, he says, you know, all citizens, regardless of race or creed, are Australians, and so on. I'm sure he probably has private beliefs that are more closely aligned with people like you and I, Blair, but his public beliefs are not. But he, you know, he says, well, we've got to bring immigration down, and, you know, basically endorses like everything, every nationalist policy that you could get away with within the Overton window, he seems to endorse. So, and he, you know, basically was too right-wing for the Liberal Party, got booted out of the Liberal Party, and he's now independent and going his own way. And I would go as far as to say that if you're in Queensland, obviously we don't have a party contesting the next election, so if you're in Queensland, you should vote one Gerard Rennick for Senate. I'd like to see him get re-elected in the, you know, he's in Queensland, a Queensland senator. I'm not a Queenslander, so I can't vote for him, but if I was, I would. I think he's probably the best of a bad bunch. A rare, sincere politician. He's called out the Jews in recent months in a way that has been quite admirable. So I would give him my endorsement. But that doesn't mean that he's a Nazi, obviously. And what's interesting is that Friendly Geordie's made a video basically calling out the same thing, calling out the Israel lobby. In fact, he's done this multiple times. He's made videos calling out the Jews, calling out the Israel lobby and their influence in Australia. He made one quite recently that I posted and endorsed, where he was literally calling out the same issue, the exact same issue that Gerard Rennick and I spoke about on that Twitter space, and then Rennick went and spoke about in the Senate, and then I praised him for doing so. The exact same issue Friendly Geordie's covered in a recent video, and I posted his video and said it was a good video. So by his own logic, he is endorsed by neo-Nazi Joel Davis in the exact same way that Gerard Rennick is. So he's kind of opening himself up to an interesting criticism here. But secondarily, what it exposes, therefore, also is that he's a fraud, because he completely decontextualized it. He would know that context if he researched the story enough to do a little clip on it. And he would know that he agrees with me and with Rennick on this, and he's publicly agreed with Rennick and I on this issue. But instead, he chooses to take a shot at Rennick because the because it suits the Labour Party in some way. It shows that he's not a man of principle. Rennick is clearly correct on this issue. The Labour Party have been complicit in passing hate speech laws that even Geordies himself has said are ridiculous. But he's trying to portray these laws like as if they're the product of the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party are, you know, obviously extremely Zionist, but the Labour Party are the ones that are in power and actually passing them at the federal level, the state, New South Wales and state Victoria parliaments as well. They're the ones in power in all three parliaments. They're the ones that are passing the laws. The Liberal Party are supporting them in doing so, but it's nevertheless Labour that have like drafted the laws and are passing them. Labour is also beholden to Zionists. Labour is beholden to the Israel lobby. Labour is an enemy of free speech. And he completely glosses over all of that because he's a fucking fraud that gets paid to take a political issue that the majority of Australians can see and are angry about and then redirect the energy into being anti-liberal and pro-Labour. It's fun, and not that I'm anti-liberal as well, but you want to attack the Liberal Party, fine. But then attacking Gerard Rennick, who was too honest and too genuine for the Liberal Party, I mean, that just shows that you're scum. So, you know, fuck this cunt. But it just shows, you know, again, the fraudulence. He knows better. Like, he has demonstrated that he knows better, and he chooses intentionally to behave like a disingenuous shill because he's getting paid. And this is what happens in politics. And this is why, you know, this is what's happening in our society in general. We live in a society of fucking prostitutes. Most people in our society, whether they might not be getting paid directly to have a particular kind of politics, but they are indirectly. Most people are afraid to stand up for their beliefs as nationalists or to say anything publicly in defense of our worldview, not because they don't agree with it in their heart, but because they're afraid of the financial and economic consequences for them personally if they do so. So people are effectively getting paid off by the system to be complicit.
I see this all throughout society too. Like, it's not just in politics. This affects companies, individuals, and influencers on various different thresholds. And as people begin to struggle more as a result of the rising cost of living in Australia, I think you're going to see more of this kind of corruption, and you're going to see more justification that people come up with as a result, or, you know, trying to justify why they're taking the money and why they're doing brand deals, essentially accepting bribes, usually to promote nonsense too. I'm sure the priests, or I don't know if you call them priests from Anglican churches, maybe they're called something else there, but whoever's responsible for doing the deal with the telecommunications company to turn a local church into a 5G tower, I'm sure he has his justification for that. I'm sure he says stuff like, well, we don't get enough traffic through here. We used to get donations and people used to come to church, but they don't anymore. We're really struggling. I need to put food on the table for my family, yada, yada, yada. And they list out this, their reasons for accepting this kind of stuff. And I was sitting up late last night. I told you this on the phone, and it kind of ties into the fundamental theme that we're going to bring everything back to, I think. I couldn't sleep, and so I was just scrolling. I shouldn't have been doing that. I don't usually do that, to be honest. I'm usually asleep by midnight. But it was like 12:30 a.m., and I got into a conversation with Ziz's brother. If you don't know who Ziz is, he was like this big online bodybuilding sensation. It would have been around the year 2011, 2012, just before he died. I think he died young, I think from some sort of heart issue. But anyway, his brother kept bodybuilding as being this fitness influencer down in Australia ever since. And currently he probably looks better than he ever has before. And he's been, you know, living what seems to be like a pretty high-end lifestyle. He's got a lot of followers, all that kind of stuff. But in his Instagram story, I was disappointed to see him promoting gambling. Like, there was a picture of him with his shirt off, like probably something like 6% body fat, like in a competition, what do you call it? He's ready for a bodybuilding competition in that kind of condition is the word I was looking for. He's sitting there playing slot machines and he's filming himself doing it. And you can see what he's seeing on the screen. And he's like trying to win some money through gambling. And you know that he's being paid by a gambling company to try to get more people to gamble. Prior to this, I only remember seeing him plug his own brands like hair products and fitness stuff, supplements, stuff like that, which made sense because he was a guy in the fitness realm. But now he's just plugging gambling. And I thought, isn't that disappointing? So I sent him a message. I said, hey, man, you know, I grew up knowing who you are and, you know, I thought your brother was pretty funny. I said, I just wanted to say it's disappointing to see you promoting that gambling shit. I think that's beneath you. It's bad for your image. I think you should stick to the, you know, the fitness type products. It's just like, it just suits you better. No offense intended, just my two cents. And he responded within a few minutes because he reads his messages. He's a guy who actually goes through his direct messages and engages with, you know, speaks to his army, you might say. He's a good cunt in that way. And he immediately, I think I struck a nerve a little bit because he immediately started listing off all of his reasons for doing what he was doing. He was saying, bro, I'm struggling. Everything's so expensive now. You think people like me have a lot of money? We have massive upkeep. I can't even keep up with my bills. I've got to put food on the table. I've got a family to look after. No one buys my products. Like 99% of people who follow me, they just follow me for the content, but they don't buy anything. I don't make enough money. So when I'm approached by a brand, a company that wants to do a deal with me, I take the deal, man. It's just the way it is. He goes, gambling, it's always going to be around. People are always going to do it. So, you know, I thought I might as well make money off it. All I have to do is think about looking after myself, bro, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's just the way things are, man. Don't hate the player, hate the game, right? And you might think this is just like a one-off thing. This is just an isolated story and it doesn't really mean anything. But like I said, I'm seeing this exact same process take place in other areas of society and it also takes place in politics. I can guarantee you all of those politicians taking money from the property lobby, the Israeli lobby, or they're in bed with China or someone else, I guarantee you they've all got their justifications for doing it. They're all saying, well, everyone's doing it anyway. That's how politics works now. This is the way it goes. It's the way it's always been as far as I'm aware. And it's a necessary evil. It's just the way we have to put food on the table for our family, blah, blah, blah. They've all got a few houses they're trying to pay for and all that kind of stuff. They have justifications and that's the point. And I think as we get poorer, we get more corrupt. And as we get more corrupt, we get poorer at the same time. So it's this never-ending loop, this feedback loop. And it just gets worse and worse and worse. But the point is we need to hold to principles. And this is what you were saying to me on the phone. It's very true. We need idealistic principles to come first. If our own well-being and money comes first, then there's nothing we won't do, right? There's nothing holding you back from being exploitative or destructive. You know, that's the kind of the fundamental point that I'm trying to make with this. Like, it's very easy to just do away with your principles and what you believe and what you previously stood for and just take the money like Judas, right? You just take the money because you've got reasons. Judas would have had his reasons. You know, it was probably expensive to buy bread rolls back in what country were they in, Joel? The followers of Jesus, would that have been Bethlehem? Maybe Bethlehem was going through an economic crisis. Judas had a family to feed, you know. He had his reasons for taking the money. He still liked Christ. They were still mates, but come on. Someone was going to lag him eventually. It might as well be me. I need the money. You know what I mean? Everyone's got their justifications for being a rat, basically, or for, compromising on their principles in exchange for money. And I'm not saying that you can't make money. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying there's a principled way to go about life. And I think holding to those values, those idealistic principles, is what makes us who we are as Australians. It's not just Australians, but where we come from ethnically. It's what sets us apart from other peoples in the world. And it's what allowed us to build the highest level of civilization the world's ever seen. And I think once we lose those principles and give ourselves over to money for money's sake and, well, it's all going to happen this way anyway and there's nothing I can do about it. Don't hate the player, hate the game. All those excuses and justifications people come up with. Once everyone starts doing that, then what kind of society are we going to be living in? It's not going to be a first world society. It's going to be a den of rats gnawing away at each other. And, you know, that's the trajectory that we're on. But the way we make a difference, as I said, is to hold to principles, to morals. But does that put us at a disadvantage, Joel, in a society that is giving itself over to this kind of parasitic exploitative process of just, you know, making excuses to just screw people over and, you know, promote all sorts of nonsense in exchange for sponsorships? If we're going to be principled and idealistic, does that put us at a disadvantage? Does that make us total outcasts? How does it work?
Well, at the moment, it does make us total outcasts, but the disadvantages that are incurred are only seen through short-sightedness and narrow-mindedness. But if you look at the big picture, the question is, are we going to have a country to hand down to our descendants? You know, we're going to die. Some of us soon. Pretty much all of us are going to have children. Are they going to have a country or not? That's the question. And through the eons, men have been willing to die in order to make sure that their descendants have their own land, have their own nation. They don't become slaves. They don't become subject to some foreign order. They can maintain their way of life, their traditions, and so on in security in a particular part of the world where they're from, their lands. So if we're going to do that, we are not going to be able to achieve that unless we develop virtue collectively as a people and start honoring one another and honoring higher principles. It's not that white Australians or white people in general don't have the material power, the material basis to take back control of our nations, our countries. We absolutely do. We have an abundance. Like, we have so much wealth, so much power. Like, if white Australians were organized even at a relatively low level, it would be enough to completely overpower any other group in the country. White Australians are by far the biggest group in this country, the strongest group, the richest group, collectively. So the only thing stopping us is our own lack of commitment, our own lack of virtue, our own demoralization, basically. So that's all that matters. All that matters is reviving the spirit and virtue and honor of our people. Everything else is folly, because you might be able to say, well, I can negotiate a relatively affluent or privileged existence for myself and my particular family within this decaying social order. And maybe that works for one generation or two generations, but the whole country is being sold out from underneath us. So on a long enough timeline, that means the end of your bloodline. And being one of the few wealthy families left in an otherwise completely destroyed and sold out country that you no longer possess is still a worse fate than being just an average citizen in a nation that your people control. So, you know, the entire fate of our people is basically resting on the shoulders of whether we can conjure up through the will enough virtue to fight for it and to honor it. So, yeah, like it's all about perspective. If you have the correct perspective, you realize there is no other path but honor and virtue other than ultimately death and destruction. And these are the only, this is the fork in the road. This is what it all comes down to. And that's the thing. Someone like Peter Dutton, is Peter Dutton a piece of shit because he has the wrong ideas? Or is Peter Dutton a piece of shit because he takes money from the Jews and he takes money from these other different groups and he's a prostitute who just wants to be prime minister, who wants to have a successful political career and will make deals with any group, regardless of whether it conforms to some kind of higher principle, because he lacks higher principles? Well, obviously it's the second case. Peter Dutton is not a principled man. He just has the wrong principles. He's an unprincipled man, like everyone else in the whole Liberal Party and the Labour Party and any other position of power in this country and influence. These are not principled men or women. They wouldn't be in that position if they were, because those positions, in order to get into them under the current paradigm, you have to basically make deals with certain interest groups. And those interest groups are operating in their own self-interest, not in the national interest. Like, the Jewish lobby doesn't care about us. It only cares about Jews. The property lobby doesn't care about Australians. They only care about property developers. The corporate lobbies only care about their shareholders. They don't care about us. They don't care about the future of this nation. None of these groups that have power and influence and money that are driving things give a shit about the future of the Australian nation as such. So if you're taking money from them, if you're working within a system that they prop up, then obviously you don't either. But if enough men did, they could win, because most Australians would like to continue being Australians and having Australia, like real Australians. Like white Australians would like to continue having white Australia. You know, they might not be as extreme as you or I, but they don't want to be completely flooded and replaced and impoverished. You know, I was talking about this on Telegram. I've talked about it many times before recently and over the years. There is no way to fix this housing crisis except through mass deportations and nationalizing the banking system, because then, say you deport, you got to bring house prices down. Like, they're way too high. They have to be brought down so that young people can buy homes and so that rents aren't, you know, ridiculously extortionate. Like, so much of everyone's income is being gobbled up by this, by the housing market. And that's the thing, is like when you have an asset class in society, if you have a type of thing that already exists, which is what housing generally speaking is, and it's constantly accumulating in value faster and faster than like labor is accumulating in value, what that means is that the productive work of your society is diminishing relative to like a fixed asset, which already exists. And I know it sounds like kind of an economic language for a lot of people. But what that basically means is that staying in the same place is taking more and more work for the average person. Securing the same level of existence is getting more and more expensive. And everyone can feel that. In ancient Rome, in ancient Greece, it wasn't even legal for you to sell your land. Like, lands were your family land. You inherited it from, you know, your paternal lineage, and you passed it down to your future lineage. And it was not able to ever be for sale. It was sacrosanct, because they understood that that was fundamentally an immoral way of organizing things. And they had like a deeper spiritual understanding of the continuity of their bloodlines, because they had a whole religious cult built around ancestor veneration. And so, you know, those lands were passed down to you by your father and your father's father and so on back through the generations. And you would make sacrifices at the family hearth fire to your father and your father's father and so on, and seek their blessing and so on. And all of Roman law and Greek law was built around veneration of the ancestors, in particular ancestral cults on particular ancestral lands where all the bodies were buried of the people of your family on those lands down the generations. And so it was blood and soil. Like, the blood was mixed with particular soil for each family. Each clan possessed particular lands, and nations were built up out of this. But so far removed from that at this point, where, you know, now that notion has been completely lost. But that was the whole reason why Australia came into existence in the first place, was because there wasn't enough space in Britain. Not enough people could have their own lands. And then we went and conquered Australia and said, here's all this empty land. And then so people moved out here from the British Isles so they could own their own land, so they could be free, so they could liberate themselves from being a worker or a slave for someone else who owned the land they worked on and their means of subsistence. So they come out to Australia, the great Australian dream. Everyone, you get your own home, your own block of land, and you're a free man. Every man, king of his own castle, master of his own domain. That was the dream, and that was what it was. That's what we achieved. And that whole thing has been stolen from us by, I don't even want to say conspiracy, because they planned this out in the open, but it's been stolen from us by these elite factions that are making exorbitant profits out of constantly inflating the property market. And it enriches the banks, it enriches the property developers, and they fuel the country full of immigrants in order to keep jacking up demand and jacking up house prices, so that more and more and more and more of your work has to go into staying in the same place, maintaining the state of existence that your parents had or your grandparents had. Now you have to earn 3 times, 10 times as much as what they did to maintain that same level. And everyone's deep in mortgages. If you're renting, you're dumping so much of your, weekly wage or monthly wage into rent that it's ridiculous, that you can't save to then go and buy a house of your own. And, you know, everyone's basically swimming as hard as they can to stay in the same place against the current. That's basically what it is to live in Australia right now. And all of the elite factions in Australian politics are all conspiring to increase the rate of that current, because they profit from the current. You know, they're all conspiring to bring even more immigrants in and jack house prices up even more, while these scum politicians pretend like they care when they don't. Because pretty much all of the major party politicians own multiple investment properties and stand to also personally benefit, not just in terms of campaign donations, but they stand to personally benefit from house prices continuing to go up and up and up and up and up. Never mind the fact that basically a whole generation can't own their own home now. They don't care about that. And that's why, and we're being replaced racially, ethnically, even faster in order to accelerate this process for the benefit of these rich elites. So that's basically the situation in Australian politics right now. It's not driven by, yeah, like there are ideological problems in society, like the kind of anti-racist ideology, egalitarian ideologies and so on. But a lot of this is fueled very basically and simply by money, because the reality of the situation is that the vast majority of Australians are against mass immigration. Even if they aren't full racists, they are against mass immigration. The vast majority of Australians would like to be able to buy a house for cheap. The vast majority of Australians would like to actually be able to save money. Everyone would, right? The vast majority of Australians don't want the streets covered in when you're trying to drive around in Melbourne and Sydney and it takes an hour to get anywhere or plus, because it's bumper to bumper traffic in every direction because they keep stuffing Indians into our cities and overcrowding them. The vast majority of Australians would like to not be sitting in traffic every day when they're coming home from work, wasting more of their time. They're not even getting paid for. So that's the reality. Mass deportations would achieve so many things that would be incredibly popular. Nationalizing the banking system would achieve things that would be incredibly popular. But who's promoting that? Who's putting that forward? Basically, national socialists. And that's it. So we have the solution. And it's not that we have the solution just because we're crazy extremists that read Mein Kampf. It's just that we're objectively looking at things from the perspective of what would be good for our people and coming to conclusions that make rational sense, whereas almost no one else in politics is doing that, because everyone else in politics is figuring out how can I posture so that I can get onto this television program, or so that I can get pre-selection for this political party, or so that I can get this donor to give me money, or get a job at this institute, or whatever, impress this group of people so I can work here or work there. That's what most people in politics are doing. They're not actually thinking about what's good for their people, what's good for their children. So that's why we're in the situation that we're in. It isn't even so much a battle of ideas, it's a battle of virtues.
It's almost like having principles, or asking yourself, what's good for my people? I'm going to believe in something that's beneficial for my extended community. That makes you extremist now. If you're actually considering what's happening to your country, where your country's going, and how you can stop your country collapsing in on itself, you're an extremist. You're not supposed to think ahead that much. You're just supposed to, as you said, hold your place in the moment and keep treading water. And I suppose everybody's afraid, you know, and it's normal to be afraid. It's normal to be afraid of the situation and afraid to be too extreme and cop all the labels and stuff. I'm not sure if this will tie in well, but recently I went to visit my grandfather and my grandmother. They were both in hospital, funnily enough. They both ended up in there at the same time by happenstance. My grandmother fell over. She's like 85, and she broke her nose. So, you know, she looked a bit secondhand. She had kind of bruised face and that, but she was fine. She was just eating her chicken and rice when I went in there. I had a bit of a chat with her. Mentally, she's still sound. But she said something to me. She said, you're lucky to be 35. I'm 35 years old. She told me, you're lucky to be 35. And she said, old age happens to you quickly. And before you know it, you can't do anything. She said, I look at myself in the mirror and I cannot believe how old I am. I don't even understand how this happened. It feels like it happened so quickly. It's frightening. That's what she said to me. Now, this is really basic stuff. It's almost cliche. But because it's my own grandmother sitting there, 85 years old in a hospital, saying that to me, it hits home. You know, I feel that. Now, my grandfather is also in there. He had like a problem with his heart and had to get surgery. They fixed some valve or something. I don't know if they call it. Anyway, I went to see him in a different ward because he was in the ward where people are recovering from surgery. I find the room he's in, but he's just laying there asleep. The blanket's like half on him. He's a proud old man. So if I woke him up while the blanket's half on him and he's recovering from surgery, I don't think he would have appreciated it very much. So I didn't wake him up. But I just sat there for a while, just kind of looking at his face and just taking in the situation. He's older than my grandmother. I think he's like 88 or 89. And I thought, wow, like, this is how it ends. This is how it ends if you just play it safe, you know. Now, I'm not having to go at my grandfather. He was a hard-working man. He was an honest man. He was a farmer. But if I'm just going to focus on my own affairs and not engage in what's beneficial to my extended community, if I'm not going to fight for and believe in something, then is this the reward that I get at the end of it all? I get to lay in a hospital bed until I die? Well, then what am I afraid of? Why am I afraid of suffering now in the pursuit of something that's beneficial to my the future of my whole community, the future of my whole race? Why am I afraid to engage in activity like that? What have I got to lose? The right to die in a hospital bed in 40 years' time? Because, you know, I'd rather contribute to something while I'm able-bodied and maybe suffer than play it safe and end up there. You know, so I looked at him for a while and I decided not to wake him up. And, you know, when things like that happen to you, it really opens up new perspective and you realize how valuable time is. You know, so everyone has to work, obviously, and everyone needs to make money. Like, I want to make money. Don't get me wrong. Like, I want to make money, but I don't want to screw people over. I don't want to sell people out. I don't want to pander destructive nonsense to people. I want to make money through helping people out, helping people accomplish something. And I want to feel accomplished in the process if I can do that. And I want, you know, the fruits of my labor. I want to see the fruits of my labor in what could be described as a development, an advancement of my surrounding community and the people in it, even if it's only on a small level. I suppose I'm just filling in space at this point. But yeah, it was like quite a impactful experience seeing the grandparents in hospital like that and realizing how valuable time is, you know.
It's true though, like, I don't want to work for money. I just want to work for the work itself. And the work is good enough, the money will come to enable you to keep going. But, you know, it's what I'm saying is not that getting money is bad or also that being poor is good. That's not what I'm saying, because there's a lot of people who are poor, but who are nevertheless, the reason why they're poor is because of incompetence and laziness and lack of skills, or it's not because they're virtuous, right? Almost not. Poor people are, in fact, usually less virtuous than people that have more on in a lot of instances, because the thing that's dividing them, as I said, is just they're not even competent at being selfish. At least a lot of people who are wealthy are at least competent at selfishness. But also, being wealthy doesn't mean that you are selfish. A lot of people who have a lot of wealth are good people. So it's not about how much you have. It's about, what are you doing it for? What are the values that are guiding your behavior? What are your principles? And obviously we want wealth and resources channeled into our families, channeled into the movement, channeled into, we want to have a wealthy nation and a prosperous nation in general. But, you know, the question is, what's driving people? And what's driving a lot of people is just fear of missing out, fear of poverty, fear of, you know, basically a very banal thing, fear of social ostracism. Most people are a bunch of pussies that just don't, it's not that they lack the capability to see the big picture, but they refuse to even look at it because it's too scary to confront that the implications of that big picture, what they might be, that those implications might mean you have to make sacrifices, might mean you have to make hard decisions that you don't want to have to make because it's going to be difficult and it's going to be arduous and so on. And you're going to have to turn up an opportunity that's going to provide you with comforts of a material or other nature here and now. And so you take that option. But the reason why we are existentially threatened as a people is fundamentally because too many of those decisions have been made. Too many of the easy way out decisions have been made. Not enough of the principled, virtuous, big picture decisions have been made. And when that happens, you get into a situation like we're in. So I mean, this has maybe been a theme in the show recently, which is that, like, we are actually the cause of our own problems. We can talk about Jews this and this that and so on. Other groups are out to get us. But one thing that I will say about the Jews is that they're more fucking loyal to each other, and they put more work into advancing themselves than what we do as a people. That's why that they're winning. Jews actually look out for Jews rather than just themselves as an individual.
Would you say that that principle takes precedence over money making, because they seem to make a lot of money as well? But would you say that they're looking out for their own kind first and they're making money second?
No, I'm not saying that. I think because the Jewish nature is fundamentally parasitic and paranoid, it's fundamentally defensive. Like, Jews feel like, well, if we don't work together to defend Jews, it could all be over, because we've committed so many crimes as a people and we're in so deep and we're up to no good. So they've got this kind of, it's all a lot of it is ass covering. They're preemptively trying to basically put in a bunch of stops to prevent justice from coming, to prevent the white man from waking up, taking back power and kicking them out and punishing them for what they've done. So that's driving them. They're just conscious. They're aware of what's happening, but it's fear drives the Jews. Whereas, like, the difference is that for us, there's the fear of going extinct. There's a fear of losing our nations that's there. But fundamentally, what's going to need to drive us is more honor. I don't think Jews are acting out of a place of honor, and they don't conduct themselves with honor. They conduct themselves with hysteria. They conduct themselves as I said, it's an ass-covering exercise, a lot of what they do, and it's selfish ingratiation, because they have a fundamentally different nature and strategy and orientation. It's part of what I was saying as well the other day about anti-Semitism, about how modernity, because modernity has developed, there's been this this kind of liberal, individualistic ideology has become incepted in this hyper-rationalistic ideology, which converts everything into a technical problem, which relativizes everything to self-interest, to a very kind of low and superficial conception of human nature, that you build a society around those principles and Aryans lose touch. You know, white people lose touch with who we truly are, because who we truly are has its roots in things which require romanticism, things which require tradition, which require a depth of understanding. Whereas the Jewish identity is fundamentally oriented in scheming. It's fundamentally oriented in manipulation, whether it be their mercantile function or their kind of priest as lawyer pupil function. Jews are fundamentally optimized because they were a race without a homeland and a race without a warrior caste for, you know, and without peasants for, you know, basically thousands of years. They became master manipulators, master parasites, living in a civilization they didn't build and parasitizing off it and trying to survive within it. And so in a certain sense, their traits are perfectly optimized for a degenerate moral society. The more degenerate your society becomes, the more powerful the Jews within it will become, because that's what they're optimized to do. If you're a peasant in medieval Europe, right? If you're a peasant in medieval Europe, you didn't even really use money. Like, you lived in a community where there were lands. Those lands you were born on and you die on. Your family, for generation after generation after generation, are kind of raised there, work there, and die there, and have their children there, and so on. And all the other families around you, the same. And all the other families around you, you know, one girl from that family marries the boy from this family and so on. And so everyone around you is like your cousin, basically. They might be, you know, your fourth cousin or your third cousin or your fifth cousin, but you're all basically a big clan, a big family that have been in that area for hundreds and hundreds of years, right? And so that's your life. Most of these people weren't literate. Most of these people, they didn't use money. They were just in this kind of organic relationship with nature. And they're in this community of people that you're raised with and you die with, that are all related, and you all just take care of each other and you get done what needs to be done. And the culture that you're born into is the only culture you'll ever know. You're not even aware that other cultures really exist very well in other places. That's all you know. and you're in this kind of like pure organic relationship with life and with community and so on. That's how peasants used to live, right, in medieval Europe. Then if you were in the warrior caste, if you were in the aristocracy, you are trained in the arts of honor. As a child, you're taught that, son, we are aristocrats. We have to be willing to fight to defend our lands that we are responsible for. Be willing to die in battle for our honor. Otherwise, our lands will be taken off us and we'll be demoted from this position. This is what we were put on earth to do. And we're from a long line of warriors that earned this position through being valiant warriors in some ancient battles. And now our destiny is to basically practice the arts of war and the arts of honor, and to practice them and earn respect through that domain. And so Europeans were optimized to be peasants and warriors in very large degrees for, you know, millennia, basically, right? That's the natural way of things, of how our race organized itself. And so this is a very virtuous way of being. It's not individualistic. It's not about how can I, you know, sell this and buy this and advance myself in this way, and what product should I buy, and how should I market myself, and, you know, that's not what it's about. Because if you're a peasant, you're born and raised in that community, everyone in that community all knows each other and is all related. If you fuck somebody over, you got nowhere to go. Everyone is going to remember for the rest of your life that horrible thing that you did. There's no escaping your bad behavior. If you're a Jewish merchant who goes from this town to this town to this town to this town, buying and selling, if you do a dodgy deal and you sell someone, you screw someone over in a deal, you never see him again. You just go to the next town and try and screw them over and go to the next town. Or you get kicked out of this whole city because if you've been doing dodgy deals, just go to another city and start setting up your grift there. That's what Jews were optimized to achieve, because Jews are not peasants. Jews are not warriors. They don't have to fight for their existence, and they don't have a natural relation to the soil. They aren't peasants. They aren't blood and soil. They are alien outsiders who live on the edges of cities and develop these trade networks and so on. And that's how they operate. So Jews have become, this is why, you know, they succeed so well in modernity, because now modernity is optimized for these Jewish abilities. Now everyone is in the marketplace. No one is in a community where they all take care of each other. No one's in extended families where they all take care of each other. We don't have an honor society anymore where basically you have to fight to maintain your position and carry yourself with your shoulders back and with dignity. And, you know, you don't step on someone's toes unless you're willing to fight them over it. And people can challenge each other to duels all the time if they have an argument about something or whatever. We don't live in a society like that anymore. There's no honor left in our culture. So people who have these virtues, there's no way of even really expressing them, or it's very difficult to express them in modern society. But if you've got these Jewish virtues of being really good at arguing and manipulating and buying and selling and so on, then you take over our society. That's why Jews run our societies. It's because our societies have degraded in their moral qualities, have lost their connection to these ancient traditions and ways of life, where our virtue comes from and why we had a superior culture and a superior people at one time. We've all become, to various degrees, spiritually Jewish. So we deserve to be ruled over by Jews unless we can assert a higher morality, unless we can assert higher principles and organize ourselves around those. And that's what National Socialism is about. Is trying to bring those virtues and principles of the pre-modern period that made our race what it is back, and give them a kind of modern, you know, form that can suit, like, you know, modern advanced societies.
Yeah. You can't laugh at honor and then act shocked when you find knives in your back, right? But isn't it curious that it's always the Jewish directors and filmmakers who make a mockery of what we previously considered honorable? Like their concept of what is a virtue is very different to what we consider virtuous. Like we consider sacrificing ourselves for a greater purpose or for someone we love, family. That's usually the thing that gets me moving when I'm watching a film, gets me emotional, because I understand it. And in a way, I long for that. I hope that one day I get the chance to sacrifice myself for something I believe in or someone I love. You'll notice with modern film, though, different types of values or messages are propagated through the films themselves, because you've got to remember, when you're watching a movie, you're never just being entertained. Nothing is pure entertainment. Even the cast and the way the story is laced together, small things you'll come across within the film, are all trying to convey a certain vibe, a certain message, even if it's just a feeling within you about something. So there's always influence happening through film and all forms of entertainment these days. And, you know, I think a lot of people have probably picked up on various types of propaganda in the film industry. Right now, it's not very difficult to do now. I mean, you watch a film now, and there was one in England recently, which was supposed to be about a knife attack or a stabbing that a young...
It was like a Netflix thing, I think, yeah.
Yeah, maybe something like that. It's just one such example.
It was like a black kid that stabbed someone, and then they depicted him as a white kid.
Right.
Hmm.
But the point is, there's a completely different set of... completely different value set. And what is understood as virtuous or desirable in terms of characteristics, individual characteristics, community characteristics, is completely different. But it's curious, though, because I saw a movie with Adam Sandler once. It was made rather recently. He was playing a jeweler. I think he ran a jewelry store in New York City. It's a very stereotypical job for a Jewish character. And Adam Sandler, if you don't know, he's like one of the most obvious Jews in Hollywood. But, you know, he's one of our dear actors. We grew up with him. We all know him as Happy Gilmore or Billy Madison. And so he's beloved to a certain extent. But what was curious is he ends up dead at the end of the film. Throughout the film, he's complete in a state of neurosis, trying to pay people back and make money for these jewels that he's selling and doing deals with people. And then in the end, someone kills him and that's it. And I couldn't help but try to understand what the point of the film was. It didn't seem to have a point. But then I thought, maybe they're trying to glorify and make out as virtuous that whole lifestyle, the lifestyle of the merchant, the struggle of the merchant to make his money and pay his debts, you know, take the cream off the top and, you know, profit in the process, the struggles he goes through, the unfair persecution he suffers, and then he ends up dead in the end, the poor merchant. And I thought, what a difficult movie for me to actually resonate with. Like, it's like, I don't understand this film. What's the point of this film? It's just people yelling and money flying around and jewels, and then the guy's dead. Like, this is kind of weird. But the point I'm making, that's the movie.
And all the Jews are like watching it like, oh, God, that cooked. Like, that was... Oh,
yeah, all the Jews will be at home. They'll be with their family crying. Oh, my God, what a great effort he made to make the buck. You know what I mean? Like, I don't get it, though. And that just demonstrates how we have a totally different value system and how to them, what we believe in is actually laughable. They laugh at it. But what they're laughing at is honor. And that's why Jewish people are notorious for having to live in other societies. Whenever they have their own society, or if they were ever to have their own society, not only will they not all go there, but if they did all go there, they would actually tear each other to shreds because there would be no one to screw over except one another. So it's like they depend on other society. Like they have Israel, right? And not for a moment does the state of Israel exist for the purposes of actually living there. It's just this central power hub where they can retreat to if they get caught out doing something really bad. They change their name to something else, and then they get away with whatever it is they were doing in another country and set up somewhere else. It's kind of like a, you know, you get
in Israel only exists because they screw Western countries out of basically manpower and resources. Like everything that Israel has is stolen from America and the broader Anglosphere, basically. And if Israel was cut off and had to go its own way, it would get completely flattened by the Muslims. Like it would no longer exist. They would immediately be overrun by Muslims and have to run back to Europe again for safety or something. Like because they're such horrible neighbors, because basically what they do is just flex on them with American power. Oh, well, America's our big, we control America, so we can fuck you if we want to. Like, and so basically their entire foreign policy is built around the idea that they can just get daddy America, or not really daddy, because it's not their daddy. They
but
can
it's
get
frustrating.
The
it's
little,
frustrating
little boy the, cuck America to come in and die for them if they ever need someone to bail them out. And America is so powerful that it keeps, you know, it keeps all the Muslims at arm's length. But
it's so, you know, wasteful, and it's so wasteful and frustrating for the American industrial, you know, military industrial complex, because they'll send like some $300,000 fighter helicopter over there, or maybe they've got them stationed there. They probably have them stationed there somewhere. They'll fly them out there in response to some, you know, terror cell threat. And that helicopter will get taken out by an $80 rocket launcher or some homemade bullshit by these terror networks. So it's so wasteful, all that Middle East war shit. The amount of resources, like valuable war equipment resources that just gets left over there and blown apart, all, you know, funded by the American taxpayer. How fucking wasteful it is, man. And, you know, Donald Trump is apparently, you know, going back to some sort of, as you said earlier today in conversation we had, some sort of pre-World War II American policy where he's going to be more about, you know, America and less about trying to install liberal democracy all around the world with this kind of
soft
American.
Except when it comes to Israel.
Yeah. Except when it comes to Israel of course.
First, America second. That's what it
is. He's trying to save money everywhere, right? He's trying to save money everywhere, but he's still going to send plenty of military resources, money to Israel. That'll remain the case. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, of course. But anyway, like we got ranting on the Jews again, but it's all related. But
we sometimes do that.
But this is important because it gets back again to that core principle, which is that what I call the stream: money is the root of all cucking. That's the thing. Like, Jews are master negotiators. They're terrible fighters. Like, the Jews couldn't go toe to toe against the white race. If we wanted to. Now, this is not...
No one could.
This is not me saying that we should. I'm saying if we wanted to, we could actually do a real Holocaust and we could get every single one of them if we really wanted to. And there was nothing they could do about it. We could get them all. We could get them if we wanted to. I'm not saying we do. I'm saying we could if we wanted to. But they're beating us right now. They're getting all of us. They're literally enacting a total genocide over our entire race. How are they doing this? The principal way in which they're doing this is not going toe to toe with us and throwing down and just beating us down and forcing us into a submissive position, forcing us into an inferior position. They are master negotiators, not fighters. They get white elites to come and sit down at the table and they put the money bags on the table. If you work with the Jews, there's a lot of money and there's a lot of resources, and they can help you get into this position and that position and so on, right? And so the goys who realize, like the Shabbos goys that realize there's a good deal there if they take the shekels, they then get to take over our societies. And then the Jews, you know, they're very skillful at basically negotiating, whether it be through the political ideologies they create, the media they control, whatever. They're skillful at bringing into existence a form of politics which suits them and impoverishes us, right? And so the reason why they're able to do this is because we sit down at the table and negotiate with the Jew. We sit down and have a conversation with the Jew. If we refuse to negotiate, if we said get fucked, like, you know, blood and honor, there would be nothing that they could do. Like, all of their power is dependent upon us sitting down at the table and being willing to do the deal with the devil, right? So ultimately, it comes down to us, like, on a collective basis.
Yeah, sorry, I'm just engaging with the illustrious live chat, which is always a bit of a laugh. Thanks, by the way, guys, for keeping the live chat so interesting. It's great to have that constant engagement. I often find it helps trigger thoughts for me too when I'm reading people's commentary and opinions. It helps get my brain moving, so I appreciate that. What's next on the agenda?
Okay, let me think.
Wrap it up. We can wrap it up early. I was started eating my pasta at the beginning of the stream, but I stopped because it's the sauce is really red, and it was making me look like I had lipstick on or something. And I'm like, fuck, I can't eat this on stream. I look like a weirdo. So I put it over here for later, but now it's cold, you know. And
oh, it's over, dude. It's so over.
So I'm just gonna have to go warm it up. I don't know. I'll figure out a solution. But maybe we can do the super chats and kind of call it a night early tonight. What do you think?
I mean, the super chats might get us on an elaborate trajectory. Anyway, but look, listen. A lot of people in the live chat trying to ask questions. Pay up, bitch. I ain't reading out your questions unless you pay up. So send the money, right? That's some irony for you, right?
Yeah. We just talked so long about like not making money a priority, but hey, this is a principled, necessary community service we're providing here, so you know it's a good reason to spend money in my opinion.
Yeah, anyway, so what do we got on here? We got some super chats. We got Lockie Kavanaugh. He said, why would you delete someone's comment for saying NSN is dying, which is untrue, and what happened to free speech? Love you guys. Well, I didn't delete anyone's comment, but there's other people that are mods in the chat, so I don't know, maybe one of the mods deleted. I haven't been watching. I don't really watch the chat during the show. Like, I don't really pay attention to it because I'm focused on doing the show. So I don't know why they deleted it, but maybe because they thought it was some, you know, counter-signaling troll or something. But, yeah, no, the NSN is not dying. In fact, we got more members than ever.
I think it's reasonable to delete that comment. One thing I learned, hopefully I've got nothing in my teeth here. One thing I learned when I first got onto Facebook and was getting into the realm of political influence, making my first ever content, speaking to the people through the screen, I learned that if you don't delete all of the rumors and abuse and the hate, then it just piles up. And all the sock accounts and the people who do that, they all like each other's comments and it just swarms your content. The problem with that is, when random people, the people you're trying to actually engage with, when they find the content and they look at the comments, they just see that everyone hates you. That's what it looks like. That's the perception that's been created by your enemies. And so you just ban them. You got to ban them because otherwise they'll do that to every single thing you post and people will think it's unpopular when it's actually not. So, you know, it's basic situation control, you know.
It's not just that, though. It's also... that then the other people in the chat, because usually the chat has a lot of our supporters in it, but the other people in the chat would then just start arguing with them and then the chat will turn it into an argument and then no one's actually listening to the stream. And it's like, what's the point, you know? So if you want to go and argue in a chat, that's why I keep a Telegram chat for all you retards called the Tard Grinder to argue with each other so you can get it out of your system. But it'd be good if the live chat could somewhat stay focused on the subject, right? But anyway, also said this whole, what happened to free speech? Free speech doesn't mean anyone gets to say anything that they want in any context. Free speech is a political principle. It means that the government can't obstruct political expression or free expression. It has nothing to do with, you know, individuals. Now, you could make an argument that, like, well, social media should be conceived of as a public utility, and therefore everyone should, if you believe in free speech, you don't agree that X is a private company that has the right to ban who it wants. You think that there should be, and I would say, yeah, that's fair enough. When it comes to like our like Rumble live chat, it's like you're not banned from posting on. You're not banned from Rumble. You can make a new account and come in and post something else as well. It's not like you're like banned forever. We have your IP address. So just don't invoke free speech in stupid ways. It makes the principle seem retarded. Like be actually rational. Also on free speech, you know, I support freedom of speech for our people in our own countries, but I don't see it as a universal right. Like I don't support the free speech of communists who hate. I don't support the free speech of communists who hate our country. I don't support the free speech of Jews in our country or of any immigrant group in our country. I support the free speech of loyal white men, normal everyday white people. I support it. Their free speech, but I don't support the free speech of our sworn enemies and racial aliens and so on, because I don't think they should be included in our political community at all. Our political community should be isolated to white people of you know, acceptable character in the sense that they're not like enemies of our nation. An ideal society, we remove the race mixes, we remove the communists along with the non-whites, and then we can have everyone else can have free speech. A skinhead friend said, are there any early Christians or Gnostics whose theology you find intrinsically compatible with our worldview?
What's a Gnostic, you know, Joel?
The Gnostics were a particular sect of early Christianity that, you know, it's kind of like it's a term that they bundle together a whole series of traditions and communities, and they aren't all the same. But the prevailing belief attributed to them, well, the Nag Hammadi, which has a whole series of gospels and writings that are not in the mainstream Bible, that is kind of attributed to the Gnostic Church. And I believe that was those were the kind of the gospels that were kept by the Marcionites, I should say, the Marcionites, followers of Marcion. Which you can see discussions of these people in early Orthodox Christian writers who were like arguing against the Gnostics in, you know, second century in particular, AD, obviously. But basically TLDR is that the Gnostics believe that Yahweh, the God of the Old Testament, is actually the devil. And that Jesus was, Jesus Christ was basically trying to liberate us or liberate people from the clutches of the demon Yahweh and show them the path to the true God. That, like, basically Yahweh is the so-called demiurge that rules over the material plane, but there is a higher, nobler God above him, which Christ's true religion was apparently teaching, which was subverted by the Catholic Church. That's what, or the proto-Catholic Church, I should say. That's what, that's the TLDR. In terms of like theology, I find intrinsically compatible with our worldview. The thing is, like, the Gnostic, that version of Gnosticism that I just described, there's something appealing about it for many, kind of national socialists or anti-Semites, you would think, because it's like saying it's creating this hard distinction between Christianity and Judaism and saying like Jews worship the devil, Christ came to deliver us to the true God. And so I can see why that would appeal to many, but I don't like the Gnostic worldview on a metaphysical basis, because what it basically says is that all of material reality, material nature, is in a sense like a corruption, that we're all souls trapped in these material bodies that drag us into like basically a world ruled over by Satan, and that all we're trying to do is escape out of like the material plane and return to the true spiritual plane beyond this world. And I don't like that worldview. I think nature is beautiful. I think God created nature, not the devil. I believe nature is good, and I believe that embracing nature for what it is actually what is right and virtuous in this life. I do believe we have immortal souls, but I don't see it as oppositional. I don't see the soul's incarnation in the body as something to kind of look at as like an affliction or something, as like a degradation. I see it as something that is beautiful and that should be affirmed, and that we should seek to understand the will of God through the structure of nature. And that is more compatible with like a medieval Catholic view than with a Gnostic view. So, you know, I think that's actually closer to the truth. But I have other misgivings with Catholicism. But I think nature is good, and God created nature for a reason, and that you can understand God's purposes and intentions through trying to live in harmony with nature and its principles and its volition. So. And I think that's more compatible as well with a racialist worldview, because if you're trying to say that the soul is trapped in the body and that nature is evil, then why would you care about race? Why would you care about, why would you even have children? It wouldn't even make sense. You're just trapping more souls in these, in like this material plane. It'd make it almost like evil to have children if you were to believe that. it would make like sexuality kind of evil, I guess, at least if you had procreative sex. And that just is obviously wrong.
Have you ever, sorry, I think I'm about to sneeze. The dentist told me I have sinuses like twice the size they should be for some reason. Probably from all the silica dust and chemicals I breathed in while working in construction. So when I eat, sometimes it's gross, but like pieces of food get in my sinuses. Anyway, that's why I'm always sniffing and stuff too. Like people are like, he's on cocaine. I'm like, nah, man, my sinuses are just screwed up. But have you ever zoomed in on a photo of an old person? And this might sound harsh, but their eyes look like they're like screaming to get out. Their eyes look like really desperate and sad. Have you ever done that? Like you zoom in on like a child's eyes, or you look at a child's eyes and they're like, they're sweet, they're happy. But like an old person who's physically crippled or approaching the level of a cripple, they're just like, their eyes are just like, get me out of here, you know? So I don't know what I believe in this realm. I've never really personally found a strong sense of spiritual purpose to be necessary for me. However, I do, it's my understanding that there is some greater power that I don't understand. I believe that we are mortals and we probably can't ever understand our creation. Possibly not. Maybe we can. Maybe it's worth trying. But I tend to be a bit cynical about the human condition. I think it's absurd that we need to spend a third of our lives incapacitated in order to regenerate for the other two thirds, for example. I think that's really an inefficient design. But there's a lot of good about being human as well, obviously. But I obviously lean towards creationism. I don't believe in, you know, our presence on the planet being a result of random molecular circumstance and evolution. I don't believe the universe started with a big bang. I don't really know what I believe, though, so I'm not someone who talks about this to great length because I'm not really sure or decided on anything.
You obviously believe in evolution on some level because you understand the importance of breeding. So, like, obviously there's a certain amount of genetic mutation. That's just, like, a fact. We know that there's genetic mutation. And we also know that, you know, basically breeding determines genetic configuration. And if you're a successful form of life in the sense that you're able to breed and to maintain subsistence and like
in a
particular environmental conditions that you will have more children, you will grow, you'll take over that territory. Whereas if you're not genetically fit for a particular mode of life, if the environment changes or your genetics degrade through mutations or interbreeding or whatever, that you can die out. And so, like, that lends itself to at least a significant portion of the evolutionary worldview. That doesn't necessarily mean that God didn't create life. It doesn't necessarily mean that there was no intervention by any kind of, that aliens didn't come in and start biologically engineering species on this planet or something, which is entirely possible. It doesn't mean that any of these theories are thrown out. It doesn't mean that it all began in this kind of like soup of chemicals that like gradually turned into unicellular organisms. And then bit by bit, it turned into, you know, fish and then monkeys and then us. You don't have to necessarily take it all. Like it isn't like there's like the hard, like insane, like, you know, American creationist Christians in America who are like, the earth is 6,000 years old and God put all these fake dinosaur bones everywhere to test our faith and evolution isn't real. It's like, that's obviously retarded, but that doesn't necessarily mean that everything's just a product of random chance either. There's way more theories that are on the table than just that dichotomy, you know?
There's obviously like a biological adaptation taking place at all times.
Hmm.
Even in the span of one lifetime, you as an organism adapt to circumstance. But sometimes adaptation doesn't always mean development. You can actually, you can actually experience degeneration over your lifespan if you're not exposed to necessary hardships, adversity, physical or psychological. So, and everyone responds to that stuff differently too for genetic reasons. But I wanted to ask you a question. You know how dogs, you keep breeding a dog with the same dog and it gets weaker, you know, because the dogs are mongrels. They're not a natural species. We made them through crossbreeding different species of wolf, apparently. That's what I've heard anyway. I don't really know all the ins and outs of how dogs came to be, but we don't need to understand it. in order for me to finish my question. Yeah, but
human directed selective breeding.
What if we're like that too? What if we're just a mongrel race that was made by something, and if we don't get something different from something else, then we gradually die out as well if we breed too close? Like, have you considered that? Is that a possibility for us?
Well, that's why you don't breed with your sister.
Obviously, but I'm talking about... Well, there's plenty of different...
We know from science that the optimal amount of genetic... in order to minimize mutational load, the optimal amount of genetic difference is something equivalent to about your third cousin, right? Now, that doesn't...
Does that mean that you can have sex with your third cousin and still develop as a species?
That would actually be optimal. If you just kept having... If you kept breeding with third cousins over and over again, that's actually the optimal genetic distance. Now, there's lots of people... Because we all share ancestors, like, within our ethnic group, there's lots of people that are as genetically similar to you as your third cousin who aren't actually directly your third cousin, but they share enough ancestors. They share, in total, about as many ancestors with you as your third cousin does. So then they end up being as genetically similar to you as your third cousin, right? So it doesn't mean you have to breed specifically with your third cousin, but someone who is as genetically similar to you as your third cousin. And then you also see that couples generally tend to look more like one another than, like, if it was by random selection. And people are attracted to traits that are obviously on, you know, obviously this has been perverted a lot by contemporary culture and other forces that are obviously malevolent, trying to encourage us to outbreed. But under conventional circumstances, people generally pair off with people that have similar traits in many respects because of this. Because if you, and that's why outbreeding excessively is bad. It actually creates mutation. If you increase mutational load, mutations can be good, but far more often than not, they are bad. It's like rolling a dice. But imagine if you're rolling a dice and, you know, if you land on five, you know, you bet basically $1,000 on five. And if it lands on five, you get $10,000. But if it lands on 1, 2, 3, 4, or 6, you get $0. That's basically genetic mutation, right? In a nutshell. Like, so if you keep rolling that dice, you're going to be burning through a lot of money because you're going to only land on...
Race mixing is? That's essentially what race mixing is, rolling the dice.
Yeah, exactly. You're rolling the dice on ridiculous amount of different mutational loads. And also it's basically as bad as inbreeding. Like, inbreeding causes all these genetic issues. So does it, like, excessive outbreeding. So there's an optimal amount of, as I said, genetic difference, which is like the kind of sweet spot. And that's where you want to be. We've actually been able to determine it with science. And that's the thing. You said, what if humans are selectively bred? Well, yeah, of course, because we direct, like, you don't just randomly have children with a random woman. Like, you decide who you're going to be with. And if you're intelligent, you're going to have a lot of reasons why you want this trait, this trait, this trait, and you don't like these other traits, whether they be psychological, physical, whatever. And then also your mother and maybe your father and maybe your best friend and all these other people around you, your brother, your sister, they're also going to say, I like this person, I don't like this person, and here's why. And if you have a society that's self-aware of eugenics, society in general would probably start also, like, having some input as to, like, who's a good match and who isn't. And that would actually be good for society. Like, if we had a society that was very conscious of the principles of good breeding and encouraged good breeding, the race would improve. But we got scientific principles of good breeding, just like we have scientific principles of how to breed farm animals or breed dogs or breed whatever. We could apply the same principles to humans and have historically for the better. That's why the Spartans would get, when that baby was born, they'd go leave them on a rock for a couple of days, because then if the baby was weak, it would die. And so they'd just, like, cull, like, the bottom 20% of their population. And it seems kind of brutal to do that. And imagine trying to convince a woman to go leave your baby on a rock that was just born for a couple of days and see if it dies or not. But the Spartans did that. And the Spartans were incredible warriors, right? Because they got rid of all the bad blood. And that's obviously an extreme example, but, you know, we've been practicing eugenics historically in many different ways for thousands and thousands of years.
To go back to the crux of the question, though, I just think the Christian spirit of rebellion, the Jesus spirit of rebellion, the fact that Jesus was riding the tiger, essentially, in his times. He wasn't someone that could be paid off. He wasn't someone who would compromise for the sake of personal comfort. And, yeah, he suffered and died as a result of it, but I like that. I like the spirit of rebellion that he represented. And that's the thing that I would carry out of or borrow from the Christian faith. That's the element that I think resonates most with me and with nationalism generally.
Yeah, well, Hitler, Goebbels, and Rosenberg all said something similar. I mean, they had more to say than just that, but they all, particularly Jesus whipping the money changers at the temple and driving the money changers out of the house of God, all three of them referenced that quite frequently as something inspirational about Christ. And they didn't focus so much on Christ's death on the cross, but focus more upon his kind of active, like, revolutionary rebellion. But, you know, it was mentioned of his martyrdom.
It is weird that people wear a crucifix, like a symbol of Christ being crucified on a cross, almost like in celebration of it. I know it's not in celebration. They don't see it that way. But imagine if you didn't come from this planet and you learned about that happening, the crucifixion of Christ, and then you saw all these people walking around with tattoos of it and symbols of it around their necks, and you'd be like, are they glad it happened? Why are they doing that? You know, like, it's a weird choice to symbolize your Lord and Savior, your prophet, Son of God, maybe, if that's what you're into. It's a weird way to depict the person who you admire most, dead, tortured, and dying on a cross.
Well, I mean, obviously the conventional belief is that was some act of sacrifice that redeems all human souls with the Creator. But yeah, it's still, you're still correct in that assessment. And
well, you should never get, let me say this, you should never get a crucifix tattoo or any tattoo if you're a Christian. Now, I'm not telling Christians what to do, obviously, but the ultimate sin, maybe not the ultimate sin, I think race mixing might be the ultimate sin, but a really bad sin, is to get a Jesus or a crucifix tattoo. You know why? Because in the Bible it says, you shall not put any marks in your flesh, nor print any marks upon you, especially not for those who have died. I am the Lord. That's what it says in part of this scripture somewhere.
Well, that's in the Old Testament. It also says bacon, and Christians are eating bacon. And so there's a view that...
I think they probably made a rule against tattoos because they were, you know, trying to get rid of paganism, and the pagans were big on tattoos. It probably got something to do with that. But still, imagine it says that in your holy book, and then you get a tattoo of Jesus Christ dying on a cross. It's like you've broken the rule more than once in one go there, haven't you? But whatever. People can do what they want. I'm not judging.
Yeah, fair enough. I could go... This conversation is a rabbit hole that I could go down, but I'm going to leave that for another day and move on. Fellow comrade sent $10 and he said it was money to fight the gays and retards. How am I going to use $10 to fight gays and retards? Like, what?
Well, I'll tell you how, because he sent another $10 after that and he said non-violently. So you now have $20 to non-violently fight the gays and retards.
What could I invest $20 in to non-violently fight gays and retards? It doesn't make any sense.
That's a week of gym membership, man. You can go into a gym and just punch on with anyone who looks gay or retarded for a whole
week. Yeah, but I got to do it non-violently, so I can't.
Oh yeah, that's true. Well, you can mog them, right? You can flex on them. You can show them like
fighting them. I don't want to mock retards. I want to go up to retards and be like, hey, look at my non-retarded muscles, you fucking... Like, that's just mean. I'm not that callous.
Have you noticed how Joel's like, yeah, never appreciative? Like, you literally give him money. He's just like, is that all? I don't care about this. But people keep doing it. It's this weird dynamic that works. Whatever. Thanks in the chat, by the way, for pointing that out, that a little bit of gratitude might be necessary. I don't know, man. Joel's got his own style people like.
What do you mean? Why? Like, if you want gratitude, then you send money to the wrong guy, because that's not what this is about. This is about entertainment. You should be thankful that you're getting entertained.
Yeah, it's not just that. It's more informative than entertaining, I think. But I try to inject an element of entertainment into it, I suppose. But Joel's a smart guy, so we're being informed.
It's used for the purposes of entertainment. It isn't about like, oh, gee, thanks for $10. Like, $10 is fuck all. Like, what can you buy with $10 these days? Like, the Jews have inflated the currency so much at this point.
You get nothing. Beef mince, 500 grams.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, what am I supposed to do? Get down on my knees and be like, thank you. Oh, $10. Like, you know, what this show is about is about information. It's about entertainment, like we just said. So that's what the show is going to be about. It's not going to be compromised for monetary benefit, right?
Joel would be a bad homeless
guy. You're going to get to buy like, the show into a different direction. The show is what it is. Doesn't matter how much money you send me, it's going to be what it is. Maybe it would get better. If you send me a lot of money, maybe we could invest in making the show better. But no one sends me that much. But if you send... The show is what it is. And you're sending money because you support that it is what it is. You're not sending money to try and redirect it, you know? You we're reading out your super chat. That's the trope. I didn't invent this as a trope, but we play into it, and I think people enjoy it.
Could you imagine the sign that Joel would make if he was homeless? It's like, give me at least... $500. What the fuck am I supposed to do with anything less than that? I need a room for the night. I don't need a sandwich. Look at me. I'm homeless. Joel would be a homeless guy with high expectations. But the same guy actually sent another $10.
I wouldn't be a homeless guy.
You're still getting money. You've now got $30 from this guy. He just sent another $10. So I don't know. This is a winning strategy, man. Whatever you're doing, it's working.
There you go. Stalwart Australia said, what are your thoughts on demographic consolidation? That is the idea of encouraging like-minded whites to migrate to a particular region of the country, say Tasmania, for example. Well, step one, let me hold you right there. Do not move to fucking Tasmania. Tasmania is the biggest nothing. Like, you know, it's a beautiful place. But we are not going to be able to achieve political change from fucking Tasmania. That is not helpful. If you're already in Tasmania, okay, fair enough. But demographic consolidation is important, but it needs to be in strategic locations. Our idea is to demographically consolidate in areas that are on the fringe or have access to key areas, whether it be major cities, whether it be major transport ways, or that are near strategic locations for whatever reason, because it's about you consolidate in a particular area. Tom uses the phrase white fortressing instead of white flight. So that you can then use that fortress as a basis for then further political activity. So, for example, say we consolidated in a rural town that was on the fringe of Melbourne, just outside Melbourne, and we took over that area, and the mayor was our guy, and all the local businesses were our businesses. We controlled the local real estate. Any Indian that came and tried to rent anything, they just would like get screwed around and not given a rental anywhere. If they came to walk down the street, they're getting shoulder checked and so on, and everyone's leering at them. You make it like a white, like a little mini ethno state area. Our guys run it. We've got our HQs there. We control the pubs. We control the gyms. We control everything. But you're still driving distance from the city. You can still have guys working in the city. You can still be doing activism in the city. You can still be involved in the political affairs of the city. Well, now you've got a strategic area where if you've got young activists or young whites that are looking to set up somewhere to raise a family around like-minded people in a community that shares their values and that and their identity, well, now they've got somewhere to move, but they don't become completely politically, you know, useless. Where if they move to, you know, the middle of buttfuck Tasmania, they are now effectively politically useless, right? So the devil is in the details. What are your thoughts on this, Blair?
I've got my air conditioner on here, so I keep muting myself to avoid any background noise. Don't want to interrupt the stream. It's hot again all of a sudden. We had a few cool nights and I was actually sleeping well, but it looks like another sleepless night for me. So the question is, thoughts on demographic consolidation, the idea of encouraging like-minded whites to migrate to a particular region of the country. They'll chase you down anywhere you go. They're going to chase you down anywhere you go. It's like Hitler said, you need to be a world power to establish your own right to exist exclusively, or you won't exist at all. So you need to fight and you need to demonstrate your right to take more living space for your community, for your people. You can't run away. You can't look for somewhere that hasn't been, you know, no one's taken up residence there yet and you're just going to go and move there. because that's what we did when we came to Australia. Look what happened. It only took 100 years for our own ethnic existence down here to be threatened in a serious way.
Yeah, I mean, Australia was good. It was good geographic real estate to take. We're losing it, though, but we're not going to win Australia back by running away from the centres of political power. And I'm not saying that you can't live in a rural area, but we've got to think about this rationally, about strategically what areas are we going to take up to be able to have a strategy to take this continent back. Because if we take this continent back, reestablish white rule in Australia, and take Australia to what it could potentially be, Australia is unique in the sense that Australia could be a truly independent, sovereign nation. Most countries are too small or are surrounded by too powerful countries or have land borders with countries that are too powerful or whatever, so they can't truly be independent. They don't have enough resources. They're dependent upon other countries in various ways. Australia is one of the only places in the world where it's secure because it's a giant island with no borders with anyone, a long way away from anything that's dangerous. Incredible natural resources. We can feed ourselves. We can provide everything that we need. If we take control of Australia and we develop with nationalist policies, we develop our manufacturing base up again. Like, you know, manufacturing used to be 30% of our economy. Now it's 6%. If we build back manufacturing, if we grow the population through, you know, using nationalist policies that help facilitate family formation and we grow the population organically, we start terraforming the outback, building, basically creating more agricultural land, creating new settlements and so on. And we start, you know, really achieving the full potential of this continent. We can become one of the most powerful countries on the planet, and we can be a truly independent sovereign nation. And very few other countries can actually do that, right? So this is a very unique opportunity that we have in this continent to truly be sovereign, to truly do nationalism. Like when the Germans did National Socialism, it was very difficult for them because immediately they've got land borders with all these hostile countries on all sides. Australia, we don't directly threaten anyone for taking their land off them, except maybe New Zealand, who are nothing burgers. We don't directly threaten anyone serious, right? So we're too far away to directly threaten anyone. And at the same time, it's very difficult for anyone to threaten us because they have to come across oceans and invade us by sea. That gives us a home ground advantage. It's a lot easier to defend against an amphibious invasion than to pull one off. Occupying the Australian territory would be a nightmare. You'd need so much personnel. All the cities are really far away from each other. Imagine if we raised a young generation of Australians how to use guns, and we had all the farmer boys and all the rural boys all the way along every single major arterial connecting all of our major cities, all trained, as you know, with compulsory military service, how to basically handle themselves in a military engagement, and they've all got assault rifles, like America style. Imagine trying to transport, say you're an invading force and you're trying to like hold the cities and you're trying to transport between them materials and so on. Imagine trying to pull that off. Like, we could make this country impossible to occupy, not to mention we could build nuclear weapons, we could get hypersonic anti-shipping ballistic missiles. We can make it impossible to fucking invade us through available technologies that are accessible that we could obtain. We've got a multi-trillion-dollar economy. America kind of can't push us away too far because they kind of need us against China. China needs us to buy our shit. Japan need us. A lot of these powerful countries need us. They've got very productive relations with us. So we have a lot of leverage in the international system that we could use. We could go our own way. We could do our own thing and say, look, we're going to do white nationalism in Australia. If you don't like it, tough titties. And we could defend ourselves. So we need to take this fucking country back because this could be a potential white superpower that our great-grandchildren will inherit if we take it back. That's what we need to think about.
Got a lot of racist history to draw on here too. Australia was a white nationalist country. It was set up that way when it was federated.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we're just returning to who we are. Like, we're trying to channel all the original energies of our people. Like, we're trying to channel some of that convict energy, that Ned Kelly outlaw energy in this, with our revolutionary style. You know, Australia is the working man's paradise, right? That was the original idea. Everyone has a dignified existence in Australia. We don't. It's not about, you know, we don't care about, you know, what family you came from in the sense of like we don't have aristocracy here. We don't have, you know, a class system. Really, we don't celebrate wealth like Americans do. We don't celebrate celebrities. We celebrate humility. We celebrate team players. Australia is really built for national socialism, both in the revolutionary sense and in the ultimate sense, with our national character. Not to mention the whole country is built off racism as its constitutive principle. So we've got a very unique opportunity here. And also we have a completely inept political class. I don't know what the fuck they're doing. They're doing a terrible job of getting people to buy in to the status quo, to the system. Like, no one really believes, has strong feelings where they really identify with any particular political party or any particular political leader. Like, no one cares. Like, in America, they can get everyone really emotional about Trump versus the Democrats and so on. And are you a liberal? Are you a conservative? Australians get more emotional almost over that than they do over our own politics. They can't get Australians to buy into this shit. They can't build a mass popular support for their policies. They're only able to rule based upon mass apathy and inertia. And that has been facilitated through, you know, decades and decades and decades of pretty good prosperity in this country. That is now being completely undercut. What happens when everyone's now poor and pissed off and getting screwed? Where's the what loyalty are they going to draw upon in this population to hold together this establishment? Like, there is an opportunity in Australia in the coming decades to push a radical nationalist politics, to get a lot of support, and to challenge a inept establishment that doesn't have anywhere near as good defenses or anywhere near as much popular legitimacy as its equivalents in a lot of other Western countries. And then if you win, you're also in Australia able to defend that victory from being taken off you through, you know, basically international enemies. So we got to go for it. Too.
Australians can surprise you. We had the Cronulla riots, the race riots. I know they're kind of ancient now, but that was just an organic phenomena. You know, that was people just deciding that they don't want other races in their community anymore. And for 2 or 3 days, they were just attacking anyone who wasn't white on site. If you haven't heard of the Cronulla riots, if you're overseas, look it up. But it's even conformity in Australia is kind of like sudden and surprising. I remember when everyone decided to get vaccinated, even people who told me they would never do it, you know, everyone kind of did it in this weird 2 month block period. It's like everyone ran out of money and they just couldn't survive anymore and they gave up and they got vaccinated. It's like even the system and the media institutions, the people who speak through those institutions, even they were surprised by that. They were like, they put up these big weird thank you Australia broadcasts on television. Thanks Australia. Thanks, Australia. Thanks for doing your part. Because everyone was holding out. People held out for a while. And then suddenly everyone just gave in. And it didn't seem like they were going to give in. I was really depressed about it, seeing everyone lining up to get vaccinated. We won't get into that. But the point is, Australians surprise you. They're kind of a more difficult people to predict, I think, than what you would expect from other Western countries. It could be the criminal element, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. But again, like, there's a... you could say like, oh, Australia, we all descend from prisoners. Well, a lot of us have convict blood in us, but also we descend from prison guards. So it goes kind of both ways. And one of the main problems that we have to overcome is the going along to get along, you know, just following orders. I'm just, you know, just trying to pay the bills, mate, you know, kind of attitude that I hear a lot from police when I morally rebuke them for engaging in tyrannical actions or whatever. That's a big problem that we have in Australia is the sellout, the apathetic kind of sellout mentality that a lot of people have. That's what we got to overcome. But the way that we overcome it is by channeling that Ned Kelly, channeling that convict energy. We're not going to be able to, there's not a conservative solution to this. There's only a radical, revolutionary, defiant solution. And that strain is very deep in our culture. We have to draw upon those energies. And other white countries don't have it quite the same. There's a reason why Australians, the way we talk, the way we dress, the way we, you know, all the profanity, things like that, the kind of humbling rituals that we engage in socially. Australians, we have a kind of down-to-earthness in our culture that you know, I think it enables, it basically enables, I think, a nationalist movement that can more kind of be a kind of defiant, upstart, revolutionary, you know, again, like we're standing up for the little guy against the system. That style of politics would have incredible popularity in this country, but no one has really done it properly. It's mass incompetence. The reason why we're in this position isn't because ASIO are geniuses or the Jews are geniuses. These guys don't know what the fuck they're doing. It's because no one serious and competent has built a proper nationalist movement in decades. It's our fault. We haven't built a good alternative. If we build a good alternative, the people will support it. It's about the energies are there. They just haven't been fucking tapped into properly by anyone for too long. So we have to have that front foot mentality, not, oh, I'm going to go and pack up and move to the middle of fucking nowhere with my family and hunker down and just drink raw milk, you know, in the woods, in the bush until what? Like that is not going to fucking save Australia. We need to have a front foot mentality where we think that we can actually take it back. We need to believe in it.
I think being self-sufficient, there's nothing against that though. Like if you want to run around barefoot, that's fine. Like little things can make a difference sometimes in your personal life and extend into your community as well. But Home of the Brave sent $5 and he asked, who would be the most ideal debate for Joel? I need to know who to spam. We need to get some conservative thought leader to debate him. What's the strategy? What do you think? I'd like to see Friendly Geordies debate you, but I don't think you'd have I don't think he'd be audacious enough to do that. So who's an alternative to Geordies? What do you think?
Yeah, he won't debate me. Who would be a good debating adversary?
Avi Yemeni. How about Avi Yemeni?
I think a lot of people would like that. I think that would be a lot of fun. So yeah, of course. I mean, obviously, I would like to debate someone like Andrew Bolt or like, you know, some of these. The ideal debate is a white conservative. That's the ideal opponent for a debate, because that's someone who, whites who are patriotic, who have a lot of sentiments in common with us, are looking to and kind of embracing as like, okay, well, that's how far you can go and get away with, and that's a reasonable compromise we can all agree upon. And it would be good to break that frame and be like, no, this is a losing position. You're a sellout. Your principles are incoherent and so on. I think that's the most powerful debating adversary rather than Avi Yemeni, where it's like, he's Jewish, I'm a Nazi. Obviously, we're on the opposite side. A debate is more powerful when you kind of are supposed to both kind of be on the same side and you have a disagreement. That's when it's interesting, because then you're actually debating over a shared audience of potential supporters or sympathizers. But other than like someone like Andrew Bolt, who's not going to debate me, not at this stage, maybe one day, but not at this stage. It's hard to think of a lot of good examples of white conservative, thought leaders or, you know, influencers in Australia.
I think Andrew Bolt really shouldn't turn his nose up at the concept of a debate with you, because I've noticed the guy's legitimacy and relevance is dwindling. And if he wants to really establish himself again as a respected media figure, then there's a good opportunity for him here to accept a debate request from you. So I don't know. There needs to be some premise or reason to demand that of him, though, and we might be able to create one or brainstorm some ideas, but it's unlikely to go through, right? And like you said, there isn't a long list of influential people in Australian politics that are worth debating. It's kind of just all of these, clingers and self-styled influencers that represent some other foreign interest. And, you know, it's kind of obvious what they represent. Like you said, it's any debate with someone like Avi Yemeni, for example, will just end the same way it started. He'll just go, yeah, but you're a Nazi. It'll start that way. It'll end that way. And it won't really achieve much other than, you know.
It'd be good, though, if we could encourage the Australian right to start developing a debate culture. And I remember, what's his name from the New South Wales Libertarians?
Someone good came to mind, because I was reading the comments and I think this is the person that RL Nationalist in the comments is referring to. Purple Pingers. Have you seen Purple Pingers on Twitter? That communist character who's encouraging people to squat in houses and stuff. But he's like a middle class boy or something. Do you know who this guy is?
Yeah, I know who he is. He's a communist. I mean, I would debate him. Like, I would debate communists, but there's no way he would debate me because they have a rule in the communist scene of, like, never platform Nazis, which is smart because if you platform us, we get more popular because we're inherently attractive. Come on, man. Our ideas are inherently alluring.
We're supposed to be appealing to the ego of these people. We can't say
no,
yes.
No, but, like, there's no point. There's no point trying to... I know them. There's no point trying to debate communists. And that's not really...
You know them? What do you either. Mean?
Well, because we're not going to convince fucking faggot Antifa types who are in polycules and, who suck dick and take ketamine every weekend. And
what's a polycule? What is that?
You don't want to know. The point is, these guys are not going to come over to National Socialism. I want to debate conservatives. I want to debate people who have audiences of normal, regular Australians. No regular Australian is listening to Purple Pingers. You know what I mean? No normal. It's all these like freaks from like Brunswick and shit. I want to get a debate opponent and defeat them who actually, that would be a spectacle for normal right-wing Australians to be like, damn, like, I'm agreeing with the Nazi on a lot of these points. He's actually making a lot of sense. I'm surprised at how much I'm agreeing with him. That's the power of the debate. That would be really transformative. So I'm more interested in that, and they're going to be more open to debating me as well. These communist types, I'm still open to debating pretty much anyone who has some kind of influence and status in Australian politics. But, it's... there's like, who should we be targeting? We should be targeting, like I said, conservatives.
Sorry, I'm just looking up what a polycule is on Google because I literally don't know. Okay. Polyamorous relationships. People in polyamorous relationships.
Yeah, that connect because they're no longer they're no longer a couple. Now they're a polycule of,
right. I don't know. So it's like the guys that have multiple girlfriends that like sleep around and stuff, something like that, right? Some weird
fantasy. It's more like there'll be like two girls and four guys or something and they all fuck each other or some shit. I don't know. It's like weird shit like that.
Ugh.
This is what commies are.
Yeah. No comment. I don't know. I'd have to think about that. It's strange. I don't know. I can't believe people...
You know what's better? Don't think about it. Just... Don't think about it. Fellow comrade, send me his typical fart super chat. Homer the Brave said, who would be the most ideal debate for Joel? I need to know who to spam.
We just read that one. We just did that one. Yeah.
Right, sorry, I put it in twice. Hypnotic said, how can non-members financially support the EAM or the NSN? Well, you can support White Australia, which is the overarching... association. If you go to givesendgo.com/White Australia, you can send some money there. So I actually shared the link. Tom posted it today on Telegram and I shared it. So yeah, givesendgo.com/White Australia, send some cash to the org. Fellow comrade also sent another $10 saying hair fund. I don't know what.
Yeah, he got you there because you were giving him shit for not sending enough, so he got you there.
Look, it's going to cost more than $10 to go down to go get my hair done, mate. Like,
If you go to Turkey, I heard you can get it cheap.
Well, anyway, what else we got here? We got a Crafty Booms and a full stop. That's a great super chat. No nonsense. Just pay up. Don't make me read anything. Chain Reaction, he's paying, I think, to try and shill some media company. Well, the thing is, it's not advertising, so I'm not reading it out. Goyboy1488 said, Christians like myself believe that our bodies are a temple, as it says in Corinthians. We're also told that when God created nature, he said it was good. And we're also told that blessed is a quiver full of arrows. In other words, children are good. I don't have a problem with what is in the Bible, but I do have a problem with how modern Christians live. I think a lot of modern-day Christians, especially in America, need to read the text closer. I can't be the only one who believes in Christ and also agrees with all your talking points. Heil Hitler, lads. Well said. This is the thing. There's a lot of people in the movement who are like, they hate Christianity and they're like, oh, Christianity's cocked. And if you're a Christian, you're cocked. And it's like, then someone comes along who's like a Nazi and a Christian who's like, well, you know, this is how I see Christianity. This is what I believe. And, you know, I'm with you guys. I want to fight for the survival of our race. You're going to turn around and be like, fuck this guy. It's like, you're an idiot. Like, he's a white man. If he wants to be a Christian, if he wants to be a pagan or whatever, that's up to him.
Have you found like, some?
Is he loyal to the race or not? If he's loyal to the race, you can argue, you know, you can argue the point. You can say, this is my opinion and that's your opinion. You can have a debate if you want. But this tendency to be like, we should exclude everyone who doesn't conform to your religious sensibilities exactly from the movement is just retardation. We're not going to build a political movement like that. And that's not what the National Socialists did. The National Socialism was a movement that all Germans, if they were Catholic, Protestant, pagan, whatever, they could be involved. Now, the party did not see fit to decide the religion for the German people. And they also said that they asked that the religious leaders did not try and come in and try and tell Germany how to run its politics. They said, we'll represent the people, we'll defend the people, and the people will be free to explore the different religions of our people and make up their own mind for themselves what God they want to venerate and why and how and for what reasons. As long as they're not, you know, engaged, they didn't permit like Islam and Judaism and all this kind of shit. But if you were a Christian or a pagan or some variant thereof or whatever, it was permitted. And I think that is the only reasonable way to go about things and the only way that's going to work, particularly in Australia, a place where most people are not Christians. They're not going to church at the very least. They might say they're Christians, but they're not necessarily practicing Christians. You're not going to enforce your particular... But they're also... Most people aren't fucking pagans either. There's even less pagans. So you're not going to be able to enforce your particular dogmatism on everybody. And that's not the way that... That's not how white people work. If you set it up as this kind of dogmatic stance, you know, they're immediately going to see you as like a tyrannical individual who's trying to impose your worldview on them, or you're just basically separating out more than half of the movement of people that want to stand and fight and work for saving our nation because of your, you know, religious argument you're having on the internet. It's fucking retarded. So, you know, have your opinions, have strong opinions, and you can say, this is what I don't like about Christianity. That's fine. And maybe a lot of what you say is legitimate. But when someone comes along in good faith, like trying to go hand in hand with you on standing up for our race, you're a fuckwit if you don't accept that hand of friendship. Like you're actually working against the movement.
Yeah, agreed very much. And I've noticed that races have an influence on whatever religion they adopt. I'm not saying that there's no difference between the Abrahamic faiths. Obviously, there's, you know, doctrinal difference that people argue about all the time. But what I'm saying is I've known Arab Christians who were almost indistinguishable from Muslims in the way they behaved and in their general, you know, demeanor, in their interpretation of the faith. So, there's that to consider with it when it comes to religion as well. But I won't chime in on that any further. I can't see the Odyssey super chats. Are you reading from Odyssey or?
Yeah, I did, but I think they're all done. I see the super chat from Comfy Friend saying ungrateful prick, which is pretty funny. Obviously, that's a joke. Or maybe he does think I'm an ungrateful prick. I don't know. But I figure it's a joke. Homer the Brave said, great answer, Joel. I agree it serves little purpose to debate someone like Avi. Would you be open to debating one of the big American conservative influences like Charlie Kirk or Matt Walsh? Well, obviously, I would debate Charlie Kirk or Matt Walsh. That would be awesome. Yeah, I'm happy. I want to debate Keith Woods, actually. I said this, you know, he wrote an essay critical of my position. I wrote an essay in response. He wrote another essay, and Elijah Schaefer said, you know, would you like to do a debate with Keith? I'll host it. And
what did he
put
say?
It to Keith. And he was like, oh, I don't know. But then he wrote another response essay. And then he's like, this settles the debate. And then he just reiterated a lot of his talking points. Didn't really deal with most of what I said. Just doubled down on some of his talking points. And says, this settles the debate. And it's like, it doesn't settle the debate. Let's actually have it. Let's have it. So I'd like to debate Keith Woods on, you know, and it's not a, on an issue that I think is important. I'm happy to debate people that are closer to my position. I'm very happy to debate conservatives. But I'm happy to debate anyone where it would be an interesting debate. A fellow comrade said, poo, to be honest. I'm not really sure what that means.
I wasn't going to read that. I wasn't going to read that one. He's gone to bed now anyway, I think. So I don't think he's... Oh, no, he's still here.
Yeah, well, I don't know what he's getting at with that, but that's his input. Kalamazoo Groiper said, I'm an Aussie Wignat living in the US. You guys and Nick Fuentes are my favorites. I love you both equally and enjoy the debate. Constant war and struggle made Aryan Europeans strong and wise. I welcome the coming dark age. Keep marching forward, legends. Well, thanks for the support. And then another individual on Entropy who just has Chinese characters as his name, he sent two super chats. The first one is, personality clashes have been a plague on many parties, notably those on the right, resulting in splits which set movements and their associated race backwards and see followers' spiritual energy wasted. Will your prospective party have any safeguards against this? Well, ultimately, this is like a human universal, and ultimately the only safeguard against it is a culture of humility, mateship, and honor. That's the only safeguard that you can have against this.
And fear. A healthy dose of fear, too, doesn't hurt.
Well, no, but I think at the end of the day, you know, you're always going to have personality clashes in any group of humans. Like, you're always going to have that. The only way that you can overcome those clashes is with a culture that puts the team before the player. And I think Australian culture uniquely does this. You know, people call it tall poppy syndrome, but I think that's a negative way of looking at it. Where, you know, we have a first among equals style, you know, old school Germanic style of leadership. And through individuals putting the political before the personal. I mean, I love a lot of like the other guys that I'm involved with in nationalism. There's so many great guys involved. It's very easy to have strong personal friendship as well as political alliance with a lot of the people I associate with. But ultimately, we have to put the political before the personal in many respects. There's going to be people in nationalism who maybe you don't personally like, but you should have a culture where, you know, spats are conducted in behind the scenes, gentlemanly way, not out in public. Or if you're in public, you can have a gentlemanly debate about something, of course. But where we have an honor culture, where we don't throw shit at each other, and where the community reacts negatively towards that, which doesn't exacerbate. I think a problem they have in the American scene is that it's all this like personality contest of which personality cult, which individual you worship, and everyone throws shit at each other. Not everyone, but a lot of people throw shit at each other. And it all gets cheered on and exacerbated. We can't tolerate that kind of thing. We have to have a culture where we look at, well, how is this good for the movement? Are we going to enable drama fags to drag things down? Or are we going to keep soldiering forward? And I think the no-nonsense, humble attitude of Australians enables us to be pretty good in this respect. And we haven't really had too many of those issues in recent years. So what do you think about this, Blair?
We talked about this like one or two streams ago, I think, and I gave some examples, or at least one example of, you know, conflicts I've been involved in. And you get over shit. So as an Aussie, you get over shit and you see the bigger picture pretty quickly. So I do think it pertains to our nature, our ability to just, you know, keep working together as and seeing ourselves as part of a greater whole. I mean, think about how arrogant you would have to be to believe that your personal feelings about somebody else are more important than what you're trying to achieve on a community level, when you would need a pretty big out of control ego to actually give in to that kind of sentiment. And yeah, you can like be fueled by people egging you on the internet and trying to see what someone saying about somebody else. But as Aussies, we don't really go for that level of melodrama. It's all just like, it's a big eye roll. You know, so we're just, this is the boys down here, man. We're all mates. And yeah, people call that shit out and it works. Everyone works together.
Also, what I would say is that when you're in, now I've had very passionate arguments with lots of people in my career, let's say, of doing this. And some of them have been productive, some of them have been unproductive, and I've learned from those experiences. What you don't want to do is you don't want to define yourself by personal drama and people that you're against and all of this kind of nonsense, because it just distracts you from the mission and actually deprives you of authenticity. You should be defining yourself based upon your principles and your projects. That's what a winner is going to be doing. They're not going to be just reacting to what other people are doing that they don't like and spending all their time gossiping and talking about other people. You know, there's times where you're going to respond to criticism or make criticisms where you think they're necessary, but you can't overindulge in it. If you're overindulge in it, then everything just becomes about, well, I don't like this person for this reason, and like all these different personal spats you have with 3 million different people for all these different reasons. And there's some people that are just literally, they have nothing else to contribute but their personal critiques of someone who, whether you like them or don't like them, is actually doing something. I see heaps of people like this online, and all they do is talk shit about a particular group of people that they were personally aggrieved by, or a particular individual they were personally aggrieved by at a certain point. Or maybe some Jew is paying them to do it. And it's fucking pathetic. You're a fucking faggot loser if you're doing that. It doesn't mean you can't make criticisms. But there's also a point at which you can become so personally invested in a particular argument that you will literally start developing the wrong opinion, because it becomes more important to you to be on the other side of this person that you don't like than on the side of the truth, or on this, or on your own side. You become more fixated on being, and this is in the micro and individual personal disputes. It's also true in the macro. Like, I criticize the excessive, there's an element of the movement, not really in Australia, but there's an element of the movement that went, well, we got to be against everything that Jews are for, so therefore we should go and join the pro-Palestine movement. And it's like, no, we're not joining the pro-Palestine movement. I'm not anti-Palestine. I'm not pro-Zionist. I'm anti-Israel. But I'm fighting for white people. I'm the pro-Australia, the pro-white movement. And I oppose Israel in the pro-Australia, pro-white movement. That's my movement. I'm not going to go and join a movement for another foreign group of people that I don't belong to. It doesn't make sense. It's about what I stand for. I'm not going to just take up all these positions that are confusing based upon who I'm against, that are all ideologically inconsistent with one another. So we have to define ourselves by what we stand for, what we affirm, who we are, not by what we're against. What we're against is derived from that. Once you know who you are, what you're standing for, what your principles are, what direction you're going in, then if people get in your way or oppose you, you go, well, here's the reason why I'm against this, or here's my opposition to this, in whatever form it takes. That is the active solar principle of someone who is defining themselves on their own terms. That's authenticity. That's living on the basis of your own values, right? If you're just, and this is one of the problems with leftists. Look at leftists. They spend more time being Antifa than they spend doing communism. Like, they literally, all of their efforts as an organization seems to be upon disrupting us and disrupting, you know, just nationalist or right-wing politics in general. And barely any of their energy is spent upon actually, like, organizing the working class into, like, a revolutionary proletariat that can overthrow the capitalists or something. They're getting nowhere along that goal. In fact, the capitalists are allied with them against us, and they still fucking maintain that alliance. So now they might actually be more concerned about fascism than they are about capitalism, and fair enough, maybe that makes sense to them on whatever level. But the point is that they're a purely reactive force. They don't stand for anything. They're just a negation. That's what's pathetic about their existence. They aren't fighting to perpetuate a particular form of life. They're fighting to destroy one. That's ugly and disgusting. So I don't want to be that. I don't want to be the guy who's against this guy or the guy who's against that guy. I want to be the guy that's for this and for that. And they can be the ones that are attacking me. I'm the main character, or the white race is the main character. The movement is the main character, and they're the enemies. They're the ones trying to stop us. And we're on, whether it's the personal, whether it's the group, whether it's the nation, we're chartering our course on our own terms. That's true self-determination. That's true authenticity. That's true honor. That's true virtue. That's what I'm interested in. And I think people who aren't interested in that, who spend more of their time talking shit about us or talking shit about some particular group of people rather than actually doing something productive, every single one of these people are pathetic losers. Every single one of them.
That's real, man. That was really well said. It was a good speech, actually. And I think it might have been a good way to end the show. Been going for 2.5 minutes.
I think I might have one more of these entropy super chats. I have three, actually.
Oh, well.
Another one from the guy with Chinese characters. He says, do you think the Liberal Party or Labour has been more damaging to Australia? Liberals have been in more recently, so to make fair, imagine infinite Labour or infinite Liberal rule who'd kill the country faster. What is the point of asking this question? Like, you know what's killing the country is even trying to differentiate between these two hunks of crap called the Liberal and Labour Party. Like, lump them together into one incestuous uniparty regime, which is what they represent. And then you can lump in the Teals because they're effectively an establishment entity as well. One Nation is, in many respects, just an extension of the Liberal Party. The Greens are, in many respects, just an extension of the Labour Party. It's all a fucking incestuous joke. It's all fucking trash. Like, why are we trying to pick between, like, what do you like better? A shit sandwich if you had curry for dinner? Or a shit sandwich if you had tacos for dinner? It's like, it's a fucking shit sandwich, you know?
While I'm eating.
Anyway, Crafty Boom said Keith Woods has to get permission from Elon to debate you. Okay, I guess that's kind of funny. Jeff W. said, has the NSN ever thought about setting up a webpage giving instructions for how an elderly person can put the NSN in their will? It'd be a good way to raise meaningful sums of money. Works well for other organizations such as the SPCA, Cats Protection League, etc. Now, because the NSN specifically is not an official organization, it doesn't have any kind of official status as an organization. It doesn't have resources as the NSN. That wouldn't work. But when we build the party or the precursor to the party, then something like that could probably come into existence. So that we'll have to wait for that. Deer in the Headlights said, good stream, lads, and thank you. And thank you. And I guess that brings us to the conclusion of the Super Chats this evening. Super Chats, actually, you know, some of the Super Chats kind of suck, but the Super Chats generated some, like, enjoyable discourse, I think. It worked out well for the show, so.
Worked out really well. I've noticed Joel responds well to kind of inspiration. Like, someone's comment or thought will, like, inspire his brain to go into overdrive. And he comes up with some really good shit. So good Super Chats, guys. It's good energy. Thanks for the contributions.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. If I was just, like, nice to all these people, it wouldn't be as entertaining. And at the end of the day, I care about the audience. You know, I'm not in this to make money. I'm in this fundamentally to provide a show people like watching so that they then listen to the ideas, which are fundamental, I think, to saving the country, saving our people. The ideas that we express in this show, and it includes when Tom is on and when Jacob is on and so on, these are the best ideas anyone has in Australia right now for what we should do politically. These are the best values. These are the best principles. It's the best analysis. Show me something better. You can't. And I'm not saying that just to jack myself off. It's actually sad. There should be better shit than this, but unfortunately there isn't.
Yeah, true. Real. It's been a good stream. It's actually gone pretty fast. I was surprised to see that we just went for... We're about to clock at 2.5 hours. And I suppose if it went quick, that means I enjoyed it. Maybe it's because I had food. Maybe that's the secret. It's either food or caffeine that seems to keep me happy throughout the process of these streams. Obviously, everyone being here and contributing also makes me happy. Yeah. Thanks, guys, for joining us. Is there anything else you want to say in closing, Joel?
No, we can end the show there. And yeah, obviously follow us on social media if you don't follow us already, but you probably do if you're watching this. But follow us on Telegram because it's all we've got left at the moment. So you can find the links to follow us on Telegram in the description of the video.
I'm saying real. I actually get it from Joel. Joel says that sometimes. I think that's rubbing off on me. It happens to me gradually, like other people's phraseologies end up in my brain. And that's what happens when you hang out with people all the time. You start to talk like them. So, yeah, I don't know what you guys think. What do you think of the phrase real? What does that mean anyway when you say that real is in like it's hitting home?
Yeah, it's just like, yeah, that's real. Like that's true. That's on point.
Yeah. Well, I like it. Obviously, I like it because I'm starting to use it as well. But anyway, thanks for joining us, guys, and we'll see you next week. We'll see you next week. What is next week? There's nothing on next week, is there?
I'm sure there's things on, but we'll do the show.
Yeah, yeah. Sweet. All right. So, well, see you later, guys.
Yeah. White power, whole victory.